Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend. I can't wait for it. UFC Vegas 34. As always, one half your host, Duo Craig Allen. You can find me, as always, on Twitter and the Instagrams, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen FNP. Now, Matt, a lot of people might comment under this video. They'll say, boys, it's great to have you back. It's a shame that you were away. We didn't have any UFC. But last week, if you did miss it, we had almost an hour and a half of content on the PFL and Bellator side. So for you OG hardcore FNP fans, I ended up going 7-2. You went 6-3. There were a few chintzy decisions hidden in there, but overall, a great showing from the boys. We had the underdog in the main event of the PFL with Ray Cooper III picking up a huge win over Rory McDonald. You had Gegard Mousasi holding on to his belt against John Salter. But overall, a great night of fights last Friday. There were a lot of smaller promotions coming up last Saturday. And then we parlay that into this week's card. We have Jared Cannonier, your third-ranked middleweight, taking on your ninth-ranked Kelvin Gastelum, a guy who's sputtered a little bit. You look at it, he was on a losing streak, picked up a great big win over Ian Heinisch, and then his last time out, well, he lost to Robert Whittaker, a thing that both of these guys share in their respective last fights, decision losses to Robert Whittaker. But Matt, when we look ahead to this week, what a great card we have coming up.
There's a lot of really fun fights on this card, and yes, it doesn't have the big name value that some of those other cards do, but there's a ton of fun fights looking up and down. I know you and I are both really excited for Pantoja versus Brandon Royval. That's going to be a phenomenal fight, and even, like, I'm excited for Vince Paischel versus Austin Hubbard. I know there's the two guys at different stages of their careers, but I still think that's going to be a fun fight when it's all said and done, and anytime you have two top 10 middleweights facing off in a five-round fight, you know it's going to be entertaining. I know Kelvin Gastelum didn't look great his last time out against Robert Whittaker, but nobody does when they fight Robert Whittaker for 25 minutes. So with the Gastelum and Cannonier both looking to get back to their winning ways, I think it will be a really, really entertaining fight in a main event.
It should be a great one. We've got a couple of little new things, added wrinkles to come out this week. And I just wanted to give a shout out before the show started. You might have seen the Jordans that I had done up by Russell Customs in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. I had Creations by Kemi do up a pair of Air Force Ones. He did them Fight Night Pick style. And we have a true Canadian shoe, one of them, with Carlos Newton, the Ronin. The other one, we've got George St. Pierre. We'll move the lace out of the way. So shouts to Creations by Kemi. You can check him out. He's out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, by way of the Bahamas. But I just wanted to give Kemi shouts. I'll have a link below to his Instagram. And yeah, any chance I can get to pull out the first Canadian champ signed Carlos Newton Canadian flag, I will. Matt, the shoes look amazing. We're looking at a return to the live events. We've got Fight League Atlantic 2 coming back to the Maritimes. That one's at Atura, Nova Scotia, September 25th. Ooh. It's looking like tentatively I'm going to be there. Are you going to be there?
We'll see what we can do.
We'll see what we can do. Same weekend as UFC 266. But I can't wait for it. Appreciate the design of the shoes. Matt, let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen for this weekend's fight. Can't wait for it. As always, presented by Manscaped. Check them out at manscaped.com. If you like what you see, use the promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. So without further ado, the Fight of the Night. As we switch scenes, Matt goes, this should be the main event. Alessandro Pantoja has taken on Brandon Royval, who's coming off of a terrible injury and a long recovery. Matt, this fight has fireworks written all over it. Why should this be the main event?
Because neither one of these guys have ever been in a boring fight. And one half of this weekend's main event is 1-4 in his last five, which isn't the sexiest record going into another main event slot. But I'm really excited for this. The last time we saw Brandon Royval out there, he had one of the greatest fights in his division's history against Kai Kara France. And then what, a month later went and fought Brandon Moreno. And we all know how good Brandon Moreno was. And that fight was reasonably competitive. I understand he got his shoulder popped out and got viciously ground and pounded at the end of the first round, but still, he made a fairly good account of himself against a champion who we all kind of know and love at this point. So the fact that he's going in there against a guy like Alessandro Pantoja, probably the biggest power threat in this division aside from Deiveson Figueiredo, I don't know how this fight can't deliver.
This is one of those Luis Smolka type fights where it puckers your butthole because you get excited about it. I know I was really looking forward to Pantoja in his last fight against Menal Kopp, he's the hotness again, so you can really get excited for this one. For Brandon Royval, what does he bring back to the table? Again, it's been a very long road back from injury. His last one against Brandon Moreno almost 9 months ago. So really eager to see what we get out of this one. And for our second choice, I don't know how you could go wrong. When we look at a fight between Austin Lingo and Luis Saldana, how could you not get excited about this one? And I could see this one flying under the radar for a lot of people. For Austin Lingo, he's had two fights in the UFC. It's been a mixed bag. First one against Yusuf Salal. Listen, Lingo was a favorite in that fight. And listen, he wasn't able to implement his forward pressure and his wrestling style. Zalal was able to counter a lot of it. But his last time out, he looked amazing. And for Luis Saldana, well, I didn't think he won his last fight. But if you go back through, this guy is a finisher through and through. These guys should be able to meet right in the center of the octagon and throw down. That's why I love this
one. I'm really excited for this fight. I do feel like the pressure from Lingo is going to play into the striking style of Saldana. And it's wild that Saldana, his record is a little bit salty for how young he is in his career. But he's on a great streak right now. And he does seem like he is sort of getting into his prime now. It took him a long time. It took him a lot of fights to finally get this experience. But he's looked better than ever. So I really am excited for this one.
Can't wait for these fights. And if you like them and you like Fight Night Picks, make sure you check out manscaped.com. Use the promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping with your order. And if you've never tired of hearing about me talking about my balls, you can check out a bit of a longer ad and a conversation around their products later on in the show. Matt, we've got a lot of great stuff coming up. You're not going to want to miss it. We got a couple more words after this, but without further ado, let's get into it. And I absolutely love this card. And the reason why I do, I get excited about these cards. You might go over to Fight Matrix. You go over, you look at their star rating, which is an aggregate of the fighters, their records, their ranking. And this one's not that great. When cards are in that 3-star area out of 5, you might kind of gasp. I know UFC 266, that's already turning out to be a 5-star plus type of card. But when I look at this one, I can get excited about different matchups. Guys coming back off of losses. There's fighters that are really getting their second, first chance. And that's what I want to talk about, Matt, because this week I said at the very start, we're going to have an added wrinkle. And if you haven't checked it out, we have a second channel. It's called 15-Minute Card Breaks. It has nothing to do with Fight Night Picks, but every now and again, we open some UFC cards. We open a Top Striking Signatures from 2020. I'll spare you the watch because it's one of our personal favorites of Fight Night Picks. A submission specialist, Gerald Meerschaert autograph card, 20 out of 25. You love to see it. But also, we opened up quite a bit of Panini Prism over there.
We did.
It got us started from Fight Night Picks, parlayed it into that channel. But the reason I talk about that, this week, you're going to have the rookie reviews. And for one of our fighters, Josiane Nunes, we didn't actually get to see her first fight, but we profiled it in great detail. Zara Farron, of course, missed weight astronomically. But we have a lot of fighters that we're really kind of wanting to talk about again. You're really getting your feet wet. And maybe you don't know a lot about these fighters. So I want to do them justice. The first time through, there's pages and pages of notes and different things that rile around and roll around in my head that I try and get out. But I want to give everybody their due. So we're going to do the rookie review during the show. Also, make sure you check out 15-Minute Card Breaks. And if you're a big fan of some of the swag that we wear on the shows, you can check it out. FightNightPicks.com. There's a full card betting guides. There's written up interviews. All sorts of neat content over there. Ian Wynn doing his own thing. Matchmaking after some of these cards. But again, you can pick up the shirts. You can pick up the Fight Night Picks Under Armour hats. All sorts of great stuff there. Link down below. FightNightPicks.com. Matt, this is one of those cards that I say I'm really looking forward to these fights. And when it comes to Saturday, I get jazzed the F up. So you're not going to want to miss any of the videos. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up at welterweight this week. We have Sasha Palatnikov taking on Ramiz Brahimaya, and I can't wait for it because it's a bit of a clash of styles. Sasha Palatnikov, you've heard me talk about it. Was he a football player at Montreal's Concordia University at one point? Yeah. Does he represent Hong Kong? Sure. Does he train out of Syndicate? You're darn tootin' he does. Did he lose his last fight and coast a little bit in the first round and try and save his gas tank for the second and third round? Yes, he did, and that cost him against Impa Kasanganai, who was moving down from 170 pounds, and implemented a wrestling-heavy style.
I feel like Impa moved down from, like, 210 pounds.
He looked great in that fight. But, Matt, in this fight, it's a great one. For Ramiz Brahimaya, he had the toughest fight of his life the last time out against Max Griffin, but this is, after all, his second chance in the UFC. We're going to throw it back. We've got the 15-minute card breaks rookie review. So let's have a look back in the time machine at Ramiz Brahimaya and what he brought to the cage. And then we're going to update our overall pick and prediction for this one and give you a bit of an idea of this fight. And a lot of people might not be familiar with the fighter to our right-hand side, and Ramiz Brahimi. He was supposed to make his UFC debut back in June against Takashi Sato. Unfortunately, Brahimi out of that fight because he had a corner man that tested positive for COVID-19. It ended up Ramiz Brahimi contracted COVID-19 over the summer after the fact. Now that delayed his UFC debut a little bit more. And he was supposed to be on Contender Series in 2019 against Miguel Baeza. And a really weird story. And if you want to kind of get into the weeds on that one, he had a great interview with our pal JHK MMA with SCMP. And he described it perfectly. And it's a sad story, really, because Ramiz Brahimi, he was kind of going through those pre-fight tests and they found a tumor behind one of his eyes. So, of course, he scratched from that fight. And that was on a card that had Baeza got a win, gets into the UFC. There were a lot of really good fighters on that card. So it would have been a good springboard. But for Ramiz Brahimi, I mean, practice makes perfect, I guess. And he gets an opportunity this much later. Now, I mean, he's had wild camps, he's been getting ready for a lot of different opponents, but he definitely has a good gym to lean on in Fortis MMA. Saif Saud really, really putting out some great prospects, and I mean, you don't have to look any further than Max Griffin's second-to-last fight, where we saw one of Ramiz Brahimi's teammates and Alex Morono taking on Griffin. I remember when Saif Saud, you get the corner cam, then he goes, something like, I think the call was 11-2. Morono goes 1-2 high kick, and it rocks Max Griffin so hard. And we've seen it from Saif Saud. I mean, you had it in the main event last weekend, Anderson Silva against Uriah Hall. Worked out pretty good for Uriah Hall having Saif Saud in his corner. So Ramiz Brahimi, I mean, 8-2, all eight of those wins by submission. He's a jiu-jitsu brown belt. He's competed and medaled at Worlds in Jiu-Jitsu, so you definitely know that he has that strength with him. But also, again, the training partners he have at the gym. I mean, we can go through them on and on and on. But Fortis MMA slowly becoming one of the biggest gyms in the world at turning out great prospects. So for Ramiz Brahimi, former United States Army vet, and this is a guy that trains out of Fortis MMA. He's cornered Syed Awad in the past. He's been away for about 9 months. Since that absolute beatdown against Max Griffin. And Ramiz Brahimi was one of those guys when I was setting up Fight Night picks that I was like, wow, this is a can't-miss prospect that it will end up in the UFC. He's going to make some noise. The trouble for Ramiz, if you go through it, he fought once in 2014, four times in 2017, four times in 2018, once in 2019. Then he got the call to the UFC in 2020. And now he's been out for 9 months since he fought Max Griffin. So it wasn't great. I mean, this is a former IBJJF world champion from just back in 2019. All eight of his wins are by submission. Ramiz Brahimi, a really fun fighter to watch coming into the UFC.
And the UFC did him absolutely no favors by giving him poor Max Griffin in the first fight, because I would say Max Griffin's still at like the upper echelon of what a UFC debut fighter should be fighting. But still, what's Ramiz Brahimi really good at? Well, he's got great jiu-jitsu, a pretty good wrestling game. All Max Griffin's game's built around is defending takedowns and beating guys up in the feet. So I don't feel like we did get a fair shake of Ramiz Brahimi's full game in his first time out. Because, and I made this mistake too, I gotta be honest, I thought he got hit by like one elbow in the clinch, got one bad cut on his head, and that was the end of the fight. Forgot the extended, I would say, minutes upon minutes of damage that he did take. And again, against a guy like Max Griffin, it really is hard to gauge a guy's UFC debut. Because Max Griffin, we know, he goes in there and fights like borderline top 15 guys and makes a good account of himself. And who, he just beat Carlos Condit his last time out. So that tells you how good of a fighter Max Griffin is. This will be an interesting fight, though, because where Brahimi succeeds is where Palatnikov struggles. Palatnikov got on our case. He thought, hey, I'm better than these boys over here at Fight Night Picks. Got in the comments, said some stuff.
Did an interview with us.
Exactly.
Maybe started the Fight Night Picks interview curse.
Yeah.
That's
which,
tough.
But that was the thing about him against Ibaka Sanganai. I thought, okay, after Luis Cossé's fight, he defended some takedowns, his cardio looked great. Now, I understand Luis Cén's cardio looked awful, so it might have made Platnikov look a little bit better, but still, when you're a huge underdog and you win in your UFC debut, I can't take too many negatives from it. And I really thought, okay, Ibaka Sanganai, we don't really know what he's going to look like down at 170.
After the loss to Joaquin Buckley.
Exactly. Ibaka Sanganai ragdolled Palatnikov the second they get onto the mat. And that really is the thing that this fight comes down to. This fight, I guess the two most important things in this fight are takedown defense, but I'd also say cardio. Because with Palatnikov, if he is fresh, I think his movement alone can defend some of the takedowns of Brahimi. And I do feel like as Ramiz is moving forward, Palatnikov will be able to get some good shots off on him. Now, Palatnikov's interesting because he does have a very extensive striking background, but I don't feel like he has that one-punch knockout threat. Throws in combination punching quite a bit, likes to end his punching combinations with kicks, and that'll be interesting to see how much he does decide to kick against Brahimai, because let's say he does start going to the body early and that kick is landing, then Brahimai's power bar is just going to go down so fast, and in that second and third round, Platikov might look great on the feet. The reverse to that is, if Platikov throws maybe one lazy leg kick and Brahimai not even takes him down off, it just catches him, just catches the kick to put it in the back of Platnikov's head, then I could see this being, okay, Platnikov's very hesitant on the feet. He's afraid to let his hands go because he knows once I do let my hands go, that's when my body's open up to get taken down. So this fight really does come down to cardio. I'd say more than any other one on the card.
For both of these guys, I listened to interviews before this fight. For Ms. Brahimai, he did one with JHK with Sports Kita. He talked about kind of the road to recovery, how this was a good matchup. I wouldn't say favorable, but a good matchup. He can implement his style. He can strike a little bit. And for Ramiz, it's not like he got beat up on the feet as bad as the Kasanganai fight, the Max Griffin fight. In the past, he was a guy doing the damage, dropping guys, hurting them, submitting them. For Sasha Platnikov, throws nice kicks, switches stances, throws a nice lead hook from either stance, and really outlasts a lot of guys. He did an interview with Odds Checker US, with James Lynch, and he kind of alluded to the fact, to me it sounded like, okay, well, it's worked for me in other fights. I'm going to do it again in this fight. Maybe feel it out in the first round, take over in the second round, take over in the third round, win a good fight, like he did with Luis Cosse. So I look at this fight, it really is tricky, and when does he kind of wake up? Because in this fight, you're training out of Syndicate, you've got Dana Rodriguez, you've got Michael Chiesa, you've got Dustin Stoitzfus, so you've got Aaron Jeffrey, you've got all these big names, John Woods, your head coach. What can you prove to me that you've learned from these guys in a fight like this? Because I think both of these guys have really important training partners to get ready for this fight. And I mentioned them both. Chiesa for Palatnikov to get ready for Brahimai is like Syed Awad to Ramiz Brahimai. Because if you look at Syed Awad, what does he do? Kind of overextends in some of his punches. He switches stances. He throws those kicks.
Gets tired in 30 seconds.
He does get tired, but he does throw a lot of, you know, blitzing attacks and things that you can kind of prepare yourself for when you're taking on a guy like Platnikov. And the grappling of Chiesa, you can kind of mirror it a little bit with Brahimai, because for Chiesa, doesn't really strike all that much. He just kind of takes guys down.
Has terrible darts choke defense too.
You hate to see it, but again, if you look at it, for Sasha Platnikov, went 1 of 9 in takedown, or sorry, 1 of 9 in takedowns against Cosi, and 2 of 9 was what Kasanganai, I can't even read, 2 of 6 was what Kasanganai needed to get the fight to the mat, to get the submission. So Platnikov, slow starter, and normally is. Ramiz Brahimai usually likes to get moving quick. So that's what makes this one interesting. You look at the odds for this. Brahimai open to minus 110. He's minus 133 on best fight odds. For Sasha Platnikov, open up the odds at par, minus 110. He's a plus 109 underdog right now. When we go over to Tapology, total votes for this one, yikes, 1,058 total votes, 74% with Platnikov, and they're split half by decision, 46%, and then you have 47% by knockout. For the 26% that have Brahimai, 39% by decision, 47% by submission. Does that surprise you? Because it surprises me.
It doesn't surprise me. I will be completely honest. Now, I see this fight being very, very close, and I can honestly bring up a pretty good argument for why Platnikov can win this, because Platnikov does my favorite thing to defend takedowns. He's not stationary. That's the thing about Sasha Platnikov. He never starts moving his feet, and even if he doesn't have a high level of output in that first round, it's not like he's a stationary fighter. It's not like he's like Conor McGregor in the second Dustin Poirier fight, where he was all boxing stands. Like, he still does move around quite well, and even if he does lose that first round, I feel like he can burn it. If you burn that first round, let Brahimai go for takedowns and let himself overextend, maybe you can get some of those reads, and maybe in that second and third round, by throwing a combination, by throwing some of those really nice kicks at range, I do think there is a path to victory for Sasha Platnikov. But I do think I am going to pick Ramiz Brahimai in this fight for this reason. Palatnikov just throws kicks too much. It's too much for me. I'm sorry. It's kind of like Zabit. Zabit throws too many, like, 720 head kicks. I know I'm always going to bring Zabit up. But for Palatnikov, it is true. He's not a fighter who can go in there and just beat you with his hands. He does need to incorporate his kicks to really get the most out of his striking game. Even look at Luis Cosse. Like, when Cosse could get into boxing range with Palatnikov, he was landing on him. But once Palatnikov was able to get his feet under him, start to move around a little little bit and incorporate his kicks, then Luis Cosce was so much further away from him, Cosce could never really reach him with his boxing combinations. So at the risk of looking dumb and laying out what I think is an all-right game plan for Sasha Blatnikov, I do think Brahimi, if he can catch one of those kicks, get the takedown in that first round, again, just wear on Blatnikov. You don't need to go for the submission in the first. Make him feel your weight, and then I think the fight will get a lot easier from there. I do like Brahimi in this one.
Blatnikov doesn't have bad jiu-jitsu. It is good, and he does have a decent stand-up game, but I do think that with Ramiz Brahimi, I like the wrestling, I like the jiu-jitsu. I don't like that his last win was about 2.5 years ago, and he took such a bad beating in his last fight, but I do like the physical strength that you get out of a guy like Ramiz Brahimi. So,
and I guess, here, I just have a question to go over to you, because this is something I think about a lot. Do you think for Brahimi, that was just one fight he had to get out of his system, because it had been so long? And I understand that's a bad performance to have on a big stage, but do you think he just kind of needed a performance, get one behind him, kind of just get back into the cage, or having a 10-7 round of max scrimmage is never a good thing, no matter what?
Well, I mean, originally he's supposed to take on Miguel Baez on Contender Series, and he was out due to injury. And then he's supposed to take on Takashi Sato in the UFC just a couple days after that. And Cornerman tested positive for COVID-19. I guess it was a full year after that. And we previewed that fight here, and I was excited about that one. So the UFC already had an idea of where Ramiz Brahimi was with these guys in between like 30 and 15 in the welterweight division. And not to say that Blatnikov's a big jump down, but it's not in the same level or ilk as a guy like Sato or a guy like Max Griffin. So I do like Ramiz Brahimi in this fight. Again, a lot of signs point to Blatnikov with the longevity and the durability, but I do like Ramiz Brahimi in this fight. We both happen to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this fight. Is it Hong Kong's Blatnikov? Is it Ramiz Brahimi? We got a great card coming up, headlined by a couple of middleweight contenders. You got Jared Cannonier and Kelvin Gastelum. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Couple of young fighters competing this weekend, looking to get off the schneid. We've got the Predator, Roosevelt Roberts, taking on La Jaula, Ignacio Bahamondes, and Matt. For Ignacio Bahamondes, I really equate his nickname with one of his former or current training partners, Juliana Pena, because she loved in that one combate fight to explain what La Jaula means, and then she just kept saying it all the time. It means the cage, if I've learned any Spanish in my life. And for Ignacio Bahamondes, this is a guy, and I made a point of writing this down. His father was a pro kickboxer in Chile. He moved to the States at a very young age to train, and he's still at Valley Flow Striking Systems getting ready for this one. You see a lot of big names coming in and out of that gym. Bilal Muhammad is one of those fighters. We've also seen who? Macy Barber there, Hugo Flores is there now, Mike De La Vega, Pena, and then the other fighter that I noticed in some of the pictures, and I really, really had to dig deep on her Instagram because most of her pictures are not of fighting, Felice Herrig. Now, don't take that the wrong way, Kayla Harrison fans, you know what I mean when I'm saying that. But when I look at this fight for Ignacio Bahamondes, I decided not to do a rookie review for this one because throw out all of the tape study that you did on Ignacio Bahamondes getting ready for his fight against John McDessie. We were really critical getting ready for that one because McDessie, old.
ACL.
Really late into his 30s in terms of fight years at lightweight. He also absolutely destroyed his ACL. Took a long time to recover. Switched gyms. Started training down in the southern states.
We didn't even think he started training until like 3 weeks before the
fight. That sounded like the truth. There was an interview that was out there. But if you want to go back, make sure you check that one out. But to me, it was the fact that Ignacio Bahamondes is a somewhat polished striker that can get hit. He throws a lot of volume. He takes chances, but somewhat similar to, and I had to write this in my notes getting ready for this one, and it's a bit of a sore spot for the Fight Night Picks guys, because Haji Bestayev at Bellator last week, at Bellator 264, Ignacio Bahamondes fights in that style where he baits guys in, he'll throw the kicks, and then all of a sudden it's a quick uppercut with that long, long lead hand that really starts to land. And for Bestayev, he had a lot of success against Ty Guerter doing that a week ago. Now, I thought the Guerter won the fight. It was incredibly controversial. But for Ignacio Bahamondes, really, really tricky striker to try and figure out. Roosevelt Roberts, I bet you 9 times, 9.5 times out of 10, he's the taller fighter in all of his fights. This is going to be one of those weird circumstances where Bahamondes, a little bit taller. Of course, we'll see them at weigh-in day. But just like baseball players, usually you get an extra inch or two in terms of the reach, in terms of the height. But when you look at this, for Bahamondes, 3-2 in his last five. And that's not the sexiest record. For Roosevelt Roberts, you could say that he's 2-3. His last fight, it shows it as a D or as a no contest, which it truly was against Kevin Kroom. Mm. The guy got choked out standing up by a guy that ended up testing positive for marijuana and then ultimately losing his win.
That's not a PED.
Now, pretty sure he ended up getting to keep his performance bonus after the fact. But for both of these guys, really sputtering, looking to kind of build back up. For Bahamondes, much younger, he turns 24 in just a number of days. For Roosevelt Roberts, he's 27 and a half, and he's been with UFC for a surprising amount of time to me. So overall, I think stylistically this fight's great in terms of the matchup. What are you saying here?
This should be a really fun fight because you brought up a really good point with Ignacio Bahamondes. You look at his size and you look at his reach and you assume that he does try to fight. And I'll bring up Santiago Ponzinibbio for instance. Just a guy who will use a lot of leg kicks, use a lot of jabs, use some of his long range tools. But he does welcome that clinch. He does really like, it's kind of like the Daniel Cormier like single collar tie. Throw a lot of uppercuts up the middle and it worked to some effect against John McDessie. But the problem was that he was eating two or three shots when they were kind of at that mid range distance before he could land that one when they would crash together. This is a really interesting thing about this fight because Roosevelt Roberts has really good defensive submissions himself, but he also gets caught in defensive submissions all the time. I never really know how to grade Roosevelt Roberts grappling just to try to base it out of 10 because in some fights it does look good. Like look at the Brock Weaver fight. Hurts him on the feet, out grapples him. Like he just looked great in all aspects of MMA in that performance. But his last two times out there, it just hasn't even looked good. And I remember the Jim Miller fight because I said this is one of those fights where it almost might be better for him to lose in the long term because if you beat Jim Miller, you only fight great fighters after that. Look at Nasrat Haqparast. He's been fighting like the Jim Miller type of fighters, guys outside the top 15, and then it's, oh, now you fight Dan Hooker. Like, there's big step-ups when you do start to fight those big names in the division, and I honestly was happy that Roosevelt Roberts lost that fight and kind of took a step back because I thought his skill set was something to marvel at 155. Then his last time out, it just kind of exposed all of those original weaknesses. And this is my problem for Roberts. I know he has good submissions. I know he's a good striker on the feet. But I never really know what he wants to revert back to when he gets hurt. Because if he does get hurt and shoots a takedown, I am worried that Bahamondes could snatch up a guillotine. And it is kind of wild because I know we like to say this. Like, oh, just because a guy's lost by guillotine, it doesn't mean like that's the way you're only going to beat him by submission. But the thing with Roberts is that he does get very lackadaisical with his takedown attempts sometimes. And he does leave his neck in terrible places. And opponents like Bahamondes, who Bahamondes isn't like Damian Maia on the mat, but again, the guillotine's a position that he can get to and he is good with. Those are positions that I am going to worry about with Roberts. So for me, it's, I think Roberts can have success at long range because if John McDessie can have success at long range, and listen, we all know how good of a striking defender John McDessie is, but I don't think Roosevelt Roberts has that same level of at least activity in his fights. So I think this fight can look one of two ways. I think Roosevelt Roberts might be able to do that. I'm going to land two, we might crash into the clinch and then kind of hold each other there for a bit, or we're going to get a crazy, crazy war until both guys get tired. I don't really know either way this fight's going to go, but I'm going to be honest, I start to favor Ignacio Bahamondes the more I do break down this fight, because I do worry about Roosevelt Roberts when the going gets tough.
When I look at this fight, and we have to take like a Fight Night Picks timeout on this one, so if you look at the overall, what would you call it, geography here between New Brunswick and Maine, there's a little island. Now, it is a part of New Brunswick. It's called Campobello Island, and I really do encourage you to look it up. There's a bridge from Lubeck, Maine. There's also a ferry that operates from New Brunswick to get there. Now, Craig, why are you giving us a lesson on geography? Well, it's not for me. It's a little bit for you, and it's a lot for Matt. Matt, what was the former president that used to have a summer home there that's now an international museum that's kind of shared between the state and the province?
I have no idea. But
Franklin Delano
Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, there not Roosevelt. But Matt, Roosevelt. When we look at this one, Ignacio Bahamondes, the former Lux champion, you love to see it. But yeah, when I look at this one, I was saying with Roosevelt Roberts, this is a guy that's been in the UFC for a long time. You just might not think about it. He's 4-2 with 1-0 contest. The scary thing for me, if you really, really like Roosevelt Roberts in this fight, and no, I don't expect a primary striker to go to try and take him down. He has 58% takedown defense, and the names of the guys that took him down: Thomas Gifford, Vince Paschal, okay, that
good
one's
wrestler.
Fair. Alexander Yakovlev, they all earn takedowns. Now, for Roosevelt Roberts, this is a guy that used to train in the past with Jalen Turner, so a little bit of similarity in terms of a really long, lanky guy at 155 that has those weapons, so I think that's a great comp. Now, for Roberts, he trains out of, again, it says Cortez Martial Arts on certain sites. Over on his Instagrams, it was Adrenaline Martial Arts and Fitness. But, yeah, I worry about, again, Ignacio Bahamondes. Is he going to be offensive? Is he going to be able to pump that long-range jab out there? Or is Roberts going to be able to close distance, cause issues in the clinch? And is he going to be able to take the fight to the mat and work his game there?
I'm concerned both guys won't make weight before I say anything else about their skill sets. Because this is a case with Ignacio Bahamondes. He's going to fight at welterweight at some point. He's built kind of like Chase Hooper. That's the best way of describing it. Like, Chase Hooper's built like me. He's still pretty young and he hasn't kind of filled out yet. Ignacio Bahamondes is the same thing, but he's 6'3".
And that's the worst part about it. We talked about it kind of going into his fight with John McDessie. Ignacio Bahamondes has fought at welterweight before. And if you look at him at welterweight, he might have a little tiny bit of a roll around his hips, but like it looks natural.
And I think he's definitely going to grow into that weight class. So this could be one of those fights where Bahamondes misses weight by like 6 pounds. They cancel the fight. And then the next time out, he has to fight at welterweight. Because I do worry about him every time he does try to go down to 155. I remember everybody gets on me on Twitter. Oh, Matt, you make a big deal about ACLs. You know what's way worse than tearing your ACL? Almost dying the day before a fist fight. And that's what Ignacio Bahamondes looked like the day before he fought John McDessie. And that's never a great thing. Like, if Bahamondes is at, let's say, 90%, he has decent cardio, he does have good volume, and he can fight moving forwards and backwards, then I do like him in this fight against Roberts. But this fight for me really does come down to that question mark kick show.
For Ignacio Bahamondes, 35-0-1 is an amateur kickboxing record. He was a national kickboxing champion at 14. He's almost 24. That was 10 years ago. How crazy is that, Matt? When we look at the odds for this one, they flip-flopped, and they flip-flopped quite a bit. Roosevelt Roberts, the biggest mover and shaker so far on the card, at a 51% clip. He opened a minus 160 favorite. Sorry, he opened a plus 140 underdog. He's a minus 146 favorite. Bahamondes opened the minus 160 favorite. He's a plus 120 underdog. When we have a look at the Tapology votes, they're a surprise to us as they are to you. 1,065 total votes, 71% Roberts, 71% by decision for the 29% that have Ignacio Bahamondes to get the win, 63% by decision. If we look at the 5-on-in for Bahamondes, decision win, split decision win. He beat Edson Gomez by knockout on Contender Series, and then he lost the decision to John McDessie. For Roosevelt Roberts, decision, submission. So maybe you feel different ways about it. I like the fact that Roosevelt Roberts zombies forward. Now, can he get caught by a lot of shots? Sure. Ignacio Bahamondes gets hit by a lot of shots, and I worry about two fighters.
It's not good when we say both guys get hit by a lot of shots.
And you can look at it. Go on UFC stats and look up the numbers for this one. And again, they're really going to be swayed because Bahamondes only had one fight in the UFC. But significant strikes per minute landed 7.91 to 6.4 received. Like, that's a lot of damage. Now, it's one fight, but it's against an old John McDessie. Litmus test of a fight. I get it. But in a fight like this, I do worry about it a little bit. And for Bahamondes, pure kickboxer coming into MMA, just like BM Lucky later on in this card, pure Muay Thai coming into MMA, it just gets a little weird. For me, I'll go with Roosevelt Roberts, but it's definitely not one of the more confident picks I have on the card.
I like Bahamondes up until I see him on the scale. And again, that really is a big factor in this pick, because I think if he is at his best, if he is a fighter who can move forwards and backwards, because that's what we saw before the McDessie fight. Like, you did set that up perfectly. He was a guy who could move forward with his output, and it would. He doesn't really have one-punch knockout power, but similar to Max Holloway versus Anthony Pettis, for instance, where he would just kind of melt you with his volume over time. I think we do see a fighter similar to that. He can beat Roosevelt Roberts. So for me, I am going to ever so slightly pick Ignacio Bahamondes.
And if you want to have fun, Ignacio lost a split to John McDessie. But the way that we've sold it, go back and watch the fight. I definitely thought McDessie won. The second round was close, but the volume through every round and the damage was in McDessie's favor. Matt's got Bahamondes in this one. I've got Roosevelt Roberts. I can't wait for the fight. We got a lot of great ones on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at light heavyweight. We have the Nightmare, William Knight, taking on the Water Buffalo, Fabio Charrant. And Matt, this is a perfect opportunity to talk to you about our second channel. It's 15 minute card breaks. Check it out. We got great videos over there. If you're a sports card fan, not just a UFC fan or Panini Prism fan, we do have some videos over there opening the cards, talking about the cards, talking about sports. But for Fabio Charrant, his UFC debut, well, we will talk about it, but we talked about him in great detail when he took on Alonzo Menifield on short notice. We'll give you the rookie review, we'll come back, and we'll preview this entire fight and what it means for this division. And in steps Fabio Chiron, and this is a name that a lot of UFC and MMA fans know and love from his time with, well, multiple lower level promotions. I mean, really, he was a CS guy. He's been with LFA. He just main evented LFA 99 back in February, taking on Myron Dennis and winning their vacant light heavyweight championship belt. And if you go back and watch that fight, it's a back and forth type of affair. It is insanely a striker's paradise. And we talk about that all the time. But if you go back and watch that, the first round, very different from the second, then the third, and so on and so forth. The first and the fifth, very similar, because Fabio Chiron, what he did incredibly well was a lot of forward pressure, really rangy from that southpaw stance, throws a great uppercut, nice check right hook, and when he wants to throw the kicks, he throws different kicks. He'll throw the oblique kick, he'll throw out some weird looks to try and kind of get you off your game, but what he was mostly known for all the way up was his counter striking and the fact that he could get backed up and he could have the Chuck Liddell type reaction. He could have the Uriah Hall type reaction where he plants and throws and he can hurt you. And if you look at a lot of his wins, majority of them by submission, and we've seen that too. His takedown defense is so-so. I wouldn't rate it as an A. I wouldn't rate it as a C. It's somewhere in between.
A B, perhaps.
The one thing that Fabio Chiron definitely has is a lot of great defensive submission abilities. And when it's on the mat, you definitely have to worry about him. The only fight where we've really, really seen him in a ton of danger is that Alexa Camara fight where he goes out there and cracks Camara in the second round. Camara's kind of rocked and then throws a jump knee and absolutely lands. Chiron does a backflip, gets on top of him, hammers away as War Tyone is in the cage to wave it off. So for Fabio Chiron, again, really long rangy striker. I got a ton of notes on this guy. It was a pleasure to go back and watch some of his regional tape and some of the recent fights that we've seen out of him since he lost that fight to Camara on Dana White's Contender Series 2019, the third season. He's won three in a row, two of them by decision. And I like to see that too, because this is a guy that was beating the guys that he should have beat on the way to the UFC or on the way to Contender Series. They even talked about it there. You know, Buck Pinio was what, 1-5? I know he's booked to be at an NEF event that I was supposed to be at. Like, not really the best competition, but if you look at it for Fabio, he's finishing them early and often. So all the way up, stuff like that's going to happen. Even in his decision win that he had not that long ago against UG, I mean, listen, the guy was 36 years old. He was a Canadian. It was with CES. And the one thing that I didn't like there before I hand it over to you, Chiron weighed 209 for that fight. That was just back in October 2020. For the fight, the championship fight with LFA, he weighed in at 204.8. So maybe the weight troubles are behind him. Maybe it was just a tough cut there. But he won that fight 30-27. 30-26 and 29-28. The judges were watching it blindfolded. Chiron won it overwhelmingly. It's a really interesting fight, though. All right, Matt. So when we look at this fight, for Fabio Chiron, I thought the defensive submissions, you got to worry about it. And a lot of people in the comments section said, with Fabio Chiron, when he gets his back up against the cage, he's usually a lot bigger than his opponents. He can end up being taller. I know he's only listed as 6'1", but he's a guy that can get your head in under his arm and go for a lot of those sneaky submissions. And against Menafield, well, this is a guy that struggled against wrestlers in the past. Obviously, Devin Clark's to that ilk. He's up there as one of the better wrestlers at light heavyweight. And Alonzo Menafield walked in there, got in that bad position, took him down, and Vaughn flewed him. So that was crazy. And listen, I've never seen a bigger foot-in-mouth moment than William Knight's last fight when I said, oh, William Knight's just going to wrestle Dalun Zhang, and he's going to win that fight. William Knight got beat pillar to post in that fight and looked terrible. So for both of these guys, they looked awful in their last fights. I never talk about the odds before we talk about the breakdown, but I want to incorporate it into what I just said. Minus 325 at open for Knight. That's gradually gone down. He's minus 193 on best fight odds. For Chiron, open a plus 275. He's a plus 159 right now. It's so crazy to me that William Knight, a lot of success. Obviously, you know, he lost that fight to Tafan Chukwe when he was on a developmental deal with UFC. Okay, Tafan's great. Then you lose to Dalun Zhang, who's a good fighter. Don't get me wrong, but I mean, William Knight was a favorite. And from all the tape study I did, I thought Knight was going to win. That open really surprised me as far as that line.
Because Fabio Chiron's not that good. It's just, I don't think he's that great. William Knight has at least shown that he is a proven UFC light heavyweight. Fabio Chiron, I understand outside he looked okay. He does have good submissions. Like, I know for a fact, though, that neither one of us were all that excited, I guess, for his UFC debut. Like, yes, Alonzo Menafield could have offered a unique stylistic matchup, But I'm pretty sure going into that fight, we were both fairly confident that Metafield was going to win. I know for a fact that I was. Now, did I think he was going to win by, like, one of those really weird, unique, niche submissions? No, not one bit. But I still had without a doubt in my mind that Elijah Menafield was going to be able to win that fight. And the weird thing about William Knight, though, is that he does have good power punching. He has, is it fair to say, a surprising cardio for the size of him?
Well, if you look up William Knight over on the Instagram, all he does is strength and conditioning.
And that's it.
There's never any, oh, I'm hitting the bag. It's always strength and conditioning. Like, he's always in the gym. From what he shows on Instagram.
It shows.
It's a thirst trap.
He looks good, though. I wish I had the muscles of William Knight. But for me, again, William Knight at least has good power punching, and he throws in combination on the feet. It's something that at least separates him from a few other light heavyweights, because neither one of these guys have any skills that stand out in this division. Like, Paul Craig, for instance. Paul Craig's one of those fighters that I always think of to where his striking might not look great, his wrestling might not look good, but his jiu-jitsu is so good that those other two things don't really matter. Neither one of these guys have skills that stand out like that, but the one thing about William Knight is that he does have a really good jab, right hand, left hook, and it is a combination that he's not afraid to go to over and over again. But the problem was that I do feel like we've seen the extent of William Knight's, at least skill set. Like, against a guy like Dae Yoon Jung, Dae Yoon Jung's a good but not great fighter. I don't think Dae Yoon Jung's going to go on to have a top 15 type career, and those were at least the type of thoughts that I had for William Knight going into that fight. I thought, okay, he might not be top 10, but he could be 10 to 15 in the light heavyweight division. After that, I don't believe he can be, but I still think he's going to have to be Fabio Chiron.
Matt in his head wishes he looked like William Knight. He looks more like Robert Bobrovsky. Now look him up.
Chet
not Holmgren.
Sergei.
Robbie Bobrovsky. But when we look at there, Chris Boucher. But when we look at this Slim fight, Rankin. Again, for Fabio Chiron, can he hang on the feet with a guy like William Knight? I know he's a guy that trained at 401 Boxing in the past. He's also at Lozon MMA. A little bit of submission abilities. With William Knight, can he go out there? Can he impose his game plan? We'll see what happens in this one. Knight a minus 325 at open. Like I said, minus 193 right now. Chiron has gained. He opened a plus 275. He's a plus 159 right now. Those Tapology votes, yikes. 1,132 total votes, 86% Knight, 75% by knockout. For the 14% that have Chiron, 40% by decision, 17% by submission, and 37% by knockout. I don't think that math checks out. But when I look at this one, Matt, for Fabio Chiron, you want to go back and watch the fight. I talked about it earlier. The one against Myron Dennis, that's a good decision. The one against UG, who was the Canadian, if I'm not mistaken, that's a decent one. His only loss was to Kammer over on Contender Series. And if we're playing MMA math, William Knight beat Kammer, and Chiron lost to him, so William Knight wins.
Chiron's flat-footed, I guess. That's the other really bad part about his game. He doesn't move well on the feet to avoid strikes. Like, there's three ways to avoid strikes when you think about it. You have your general footwork, you have head movement, and then you have trunk movement as well. Chiron doesn't check any of those boxes, and the real issue that I do have is when William Knight does move forward, and that's the thing, he does move forward when he strikes, you're just going to run out of places to go. If Chiron does get his back up against the cage, as William Knight's by far his best position, so I do like William Knight if he is able to throw in combination. I think he could get him out of there in the first round. I think we could see, I don't often say this, but I'm going to play it my flag right now. I think we're going to see a Chaos Williams, Alex Morono type knockout in this fight. I really do.
Knight wins by knockout, and I know I've talked about it enough, and those Tapology voters don't agree with me. What's Fabio Chiron to win by submission? I know this is kind of like, didn't really plan for it, but if we have a look at the odds for that one, Chiron wins inside the distance, plus 350. Where is it? Chiron, scorecards, no action. Chiron wins by knockout.
They only have the rounds for
submission. Chiron by submission. Rounds, like we're talking like plus 1,800, plus 1,400, somewhere in around that. Maybe you like that. I ever so slightly like Knight. It scares me, though. Again, Dae Yoon Jung had a draw against Sam Alvey coming into the fight against Knight, and he looked like an absolute force, like the next great at light heavyweight. So that concerns me enough to stay away from it. It's a pop and popcorn fight for me. I'm going with Knight. You're going with Knight.
I think he's going to win by stoppage.
Let us know down below in the comments section. Will this be another foot and mouth incident like the Knight fight against Dae Yoon Jung? But we both happen to win this one representing Thornton Martial Arts. Let us know. Great fights coming up at the top of this card. Cannoneer and Gaslam. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Inside baseball, normally with the graphics, I try to do everybody justice. If there's a big height disparity, I try and make everybody match up. This fight's going to look cartoonish and wild. We have Sweden's Biomlecki taking on Josiane Nunes from Brazil. Matt, this is our first opportunity to give shouts to our second channel. It's 15-minute card breaks, and if you haven't checked it out, we get some great videos over there. We open a few blaster boxes of the first edition of Panini Prism. We also open some UFC Striking Signatures. We got a Gerald Mir shirt. I was excited about it. All that being said, we already gave Josiane Nunez her flowers. We pumped her tires. We gave her a great introduction. She was originally supposed to fight France's Zara Farron back quite some time ago. Unfortunately, Zara Farron missed weight by epic proportions. And Josiane Nunez has been on the shelf for a number of months, but she still has that UFC contract. She still has a shot to take on Bia Malecki. So we're going to throw it back to the rookie review. We're going to talk a little bit about Bia Malecki, and then we're going to offer up our preview and a prediction. Like I said, she's taking on Brazil's Josiane Nunez, and I've watched a lot of her fights. There's a lot of tape out there. It might not be the best shot stuff, but you can find it out there. She's a Muay Thai expert. She's a southpaw. She is gotta be the shortest bantamweight in this division. She's 5'2". She stands really low. She throws a lot of power kicks. She looks like she's tired from the first second of the fight. She throws in combination. She's got power on single shots. But the best thing that Josiane Nunez does, it's something that Andrei Arlovsky does well up on top of this card. She will blitz forward and land with power. And once she backs her opponents up to the fence, it's, to steal a phrase from Michael Schiavello, it's good night, Irene.
It will be interesting because you, again, as someone mentioned it, the clinch game of Zara. If she is able to clinch up, get a nice Muay Thai clinch, and throw knees up the middle, those are going to be really hard for Nunez all night. But the problem with that is going to be Nunez is going to be able to throw all those body shots and really get on the inside that much easier.
The plum clinch is actually Josiane Nunez's best position. It's even against taller opponents, that's been her best position. So let's focus on Josiane Nunez a little bit more. We'll break it out. She got signed to the UFC a little bit ago. She's an MTK fighter. She's been signed with them for some time. And again, very much a Muay Thai fighter. It's not just because she wears the Thai trunks. You see it in her training. You see it from where she's coming from. She's out of Striker's house. But this is the really interesting thing. You look at these two records. From Nunez, the one loss, it's against Ty LaSantos. Okay, that's going to happen. Go over to her Instagram. See where she's training out of. I said Striker's house, and it is primarily there. But she also spends time at Asher Fight Team with Viviani Paheia. Maybe didn't have the best run in the UFC, but still was UFC caliber. Fought really good names, actually. And Ty LaSantos trains there. So they all train together. I love that for Nunez, who, again, you watch these fights and you go, geez, I can't get a read on her. And honest to goodness, it is hard to get a read on her. The one thing that I really don't like is the fact that she is a fish out of water when it comes to wrestling and grappling. She is bad at it.
We have two of those, Craig.
Exactly. She gets taken down very easy and controlled. If you go back and you watch her second to last fight with Dione Barboza, that was a fight where Barboza had Danilo Marquez in her corner. She gets her down. She stays on top. And then Barboza starts to get a little bit tired. And then in the very end, it's classic Nunez. She's just going in there and hammering away and then finishes the fight. She did the same thing in her last fight against Zbonic. And she did it in the fight before that against Araujo, who was coming in there, pro debut for her. They struck. And the really weird thing about that one was you had Nunez, who held Araujo in just a guillotine up against the cage. And Araujo was a lot taller. You'd think with a taller opponent, geez, that'd be pretty easy to get out of, but it wasn't. And I'm not joking. 4.5 minutes of my life were spent watching Nunez hold that in. Then the second round comes out, Araujo's tired, and she gets finished by Nunez. So for Nunez, not the highest level of competition, good strikers. So Matt, the original Josiane Nunez, the nickname is Josie, the debut was supposed to be at UFC Fight Night, Whitaker versus Gastelum. She was supposed to take on Farron, Farron missed weight. And Josiane Nunez hasn't fought since, so this is a welcome back. We did go in the time machine. What about Bia Malecki? Now, she's a really interesting case. She didn't have any pro MMA fights before the Ultimate Season or Ultimate Fighter Season 28 heavy hitters, which is weird. And I've never in Fight Night Picks history put an asterisk next to a record on the show. But if you go into ESPN's website and the UFC's website, they're kind of in cahoots with the way that the records work, because if you're on or in a three-round fight on The Ultimate Fighter, even though it's an exhibition fight, they'll count it on your record. So I kind of play here or there. Bia Malecki has two pro fights that weren't on The Ultimate Fighter. They're both in the UFC. They're both wins. They're both weird, too.
They are.
And let's let you take over.
Bia Malecki, I don't ever know if she's a good fighter or if she is just big for this weight division, because that's the first thing that I need to get out of the way before we do anything. the whole season of that heavyweight and, like, the women's 145ers, it just didn't really work out. And I know the Ultimate Fighter, it's back now. There's Volkanovski versus Brian Ortega. I don't know about you, Craig, but personally, I probably haven't been following along as closely as I should be.
I don't give a rat's behind.
There you go. But for Robert Whittaker, Calvin Gastelum, I did watch a little bit. You know, I was interested to see. I thought that was going to be a good middleweight title fight. No one from that season still fights at 145, and I think that's a really big issue. Like, everybody either went down to 135 where there is a division, or they just got let go from the UFC and eventually went to Bellator. Now, luckily for Bea Malecki, her and Macy Chaisson, luckily they can make the 135-pound weight division.
And Penny Kanzad.
And Penny Kanzad, exactly. See, I knew I was forgetting someone. But the difference is that Bea Malecki's level of competition, at least up until this point, hasn't been near those other two fighters.
Well, this is the crazy thing. For Bea Malecki, her UFC debut, it's close to home. She takes on Duda Santana. She is an underdog quite heavily. Duda Santana looked amazing in that fight. She was only like 22 years old. She didn't look like it, but she was great in that fight. She was pumping the jab. She was throwing in combinations. She had her way. In the first round, she looked amazing. She was definitely deserving of the odds that were placed on her. Second round, Duda Santana starts out really, really powerfully. She pushes Malecki up against the cage. She torques for a takedown. And then Malecki ends up on top of her. Malecki just lands some punches. And that's the end of the fight.
And this kind of comes back to my Bea Malecki theory. Does she win fights because she is the much larger fighter in some cases? Because
she softens her up and she submits her. But the point is, it was just a really weird fight where Malecki was losing until she won there.
There was someone, I forget the other fighter who I brought this up in one of their fights, but I remember saying they might only win this because they're significantly bigger. This is the thing, Bea Malecki, she throws strikes to keep range or to maintain range, but she can't maintain range. Her opponents don't have respect for her power a lot of the times. So that's the real issue with Bea Malecki. Her strikes might look good, and yes, well, technically they are all probably, like, they have good technique behind them. None of her opponents respect her power, and since they don't respect her power, they could crash into her constantly, and that really is the big problem with Bea Malecki. I think if she did have the Muay Thai background that we talk about...
No.
Just let me elaborate. If she fought like someone who had her Muay Thai background, if she was someone who could work behind the jab, crash in with elbows, throw a lot of leg kicks, then I'd feel really confident picking Bea Malecki in future fights. But the problem with Malecki is she resorts to just kind of throwing a lot of jabs and her opponents rush forward. And the problem is, if you have a Muay Thai background, you have ways to negate some of these techniques. Like, she should have a much better clinch than from what we've seen in the UFC. She should have better distance strikes from what we've seen in the UFC. And for all these reasons, I could see Josiane Nunes winning a very boring decision of using a lot of cage control against Bea Malecki. I think it's easy to move forward on Bea Malecki, and I think that if Josiane Nunes can avoid the big shot, which is easier, which is honestly like fairly easy against Bea Malecki, I think she can win sort of a boring, drawn-out fight.
When I look at this one for Bea Malecki, you talked about it, let's really get in depth. So she was on the Swedish national team for Muay Thai. She is a Swedish and European and world champ. She's also a full-fledged mechanical engineer.
Which is very impressive.
That's crazy because I couldn't hack it in chemical engineering, so good for her with mechanical. But she's somebody that I've seen kind of cross-train with a lot of different fighters. She had a really interesting corner last time out. It was Cheyenne Bays, and I've seen her training in the States with the Bays family, I guess, her and JP. These were the words that were used because Saif Saud wasn't in her corner last fight against Veronica Macedo. And if you go back and watch that fight, it's kind of a tale of two strikers because for as good as Macedo is on the ground, she is and primarily has always been a Taekwondo fighter. So it's Taekwondo versus Muay Thai. And in the first round, Macedo looks great. She's on fire. But the trouble was, Macedo's not a 135er. She took that fight at 35. She expended her gas tank in the first round. And then the second round, the third round, Malecki's a bigger fighter. She's more conditioned for the weight class. And she's able to just kind of take over and pick apart. And she doesn't fall for, you know, Macedo pulling guard or Macedo trying for some of the submissions. This is what Cheyenne Bays said in the corner between the first and the second round. Now, no Saif Saud, but she gave the coach Saif, mantra. You better light that fire in your ass right now. We're in Brazil. And where does she live? She lives in Brazil. No, she doesn't. Veronica Macedo's from Colombia.
Yeah.
And she doesn't live there. She spent a lot of time in the States, too.
But I think Saif Saud wouldn't have said those words.
Oh, I don't know. But when I look at this one, for Bea Malecki, the combinations that I picked up going back and watching the fights, it's a lot of 1-1-2, 1-1-2, jab-jab cross, jab-jab cross, close the distance, not a ton of kicks. For Josiane Nunes, all she does is rush forward and take chances.
And honestly, that's probably enough to beat Mia Malecki. This is the problem. The fact that we're throwing it up to Nunes just moving forward could win this fight, or the fact that Mia Malecki has, what, a 7-inch height advantage could win her this fight. I don't really think there's a lot more technique to break down than that. Like, Mia Malecki is a fighter who needs her range, and this highlight was on Twitter today, so it's just fresh in my mind. When Ross Pearson knocked out Gray Maynard, Ross Pearson, at distance, he's used a lot of jabs, he had really good boxing, similar to Gray Maynard. But when Gray Maynard takes a step in, a lot of guys, even boxers especially, when you move in, they have power on the inside to hurt you and make you pay for moving forward. Mia Malecki, unless you're standing at the extent of the range of her punches, she doesn't have any of that power, any of those inside moves. Like, that's the problem with Mia Malecki. If she had this crazy Muay Thai game, and if she was so good at Muay Thai, like Anderson Silva, for instance, he was somebody who I don't even believe had one World Muay Thai Championship. He still beat Rich Franklin twice by just using the Muay Thai clinch, because he has those inside weapons. And those are things I don't think Mia Malecki possesses. The last thing I'm going to say, though, and this is the honest truth, I still think Mia Malecki is going to win this because she's the bigger fighter. I don't think Josiane Nunes has the wrestling that a fighter like Jessica Andrade had at this weight division. Because you'll remember, Jessica Andrade beat Raquel Pennington at 135, and she herself is only like 5'2". The difference is that Jessica Andrade, A, might be pound for pound the most physically strong fighter in the UFC. And I'm not joking at all. She lifts chicks over her head and slams them down. But she also does have a very, very in-depth and very diverse jiu-jitsu and wrestling game. And that's why she was able to be successful. I think Nunes has some of those aspects, but I don't think she's nearly as polished of a fighter as Jessica Andrade was. So for those reasons, I think Mia Malecki's going to win.
It's weird because, and I want to give credit where credit's due, because I know somewhere out there they're listening, but ASMR Critique left a couple of really good comments yesterday about this fight. I screenshotted them to my phone because I wanted to bring them up. First one, I agree that Nunes' ground game is very subpar, but Dianne Barboza is an expert at jiu-jitsu. She was a fighter that had Danilo Marquez in her corner, who just competed at Submission Underground last weekend. And by the second round, her jiu-jitsu fell apart. She was exhausted, and for that, it shows that Nunes overcomes, whether it's on the feet or on the ground. As far as level competition, Nunes fought all undefeated fighters in her last four fights, a combined 9-0. One more thing to mention, Nunes' fight against Tyler Santos was many years ago, 7 or 8 years. Nunes wasn't even the same fighter back then. It took her a whole 2 years to fight again, and then she took another 2.5 years off before her next fight. This is where her career really began.
He's defending Josiane Nunes like I defend Kyle Lowry. Something's going on right now.
Almost 5 years after Tyler Santos. Since then, Nunes 5-0 with 5 stoppages. And like I said, her last 4 fights were all against undefeated fighters.
Is it her brother?
I like all... It might be Josiane Nunes' brother. I don't know. But they're all very good points about Nunes. I think she's one of those fighters that rushes in, takes a lot of chances. To me, and it's a cheap comparison, and it's not because they're both Brazilian, but it's because they're both very green and coming in against names that people recognize. Melissa Gatto, when she came in against Victoria Leonardo, it was like, I haven't seen Gatto in a long time, and she didn't look very good in her other fights. And for Josiane Nunes, it's, well, the competition was decent. It's really tough to tell. So let's have a look at the odds. We'll offer you up those. Malecki open a minus 130 favorite. She's minus 154 right now. Nunes open a plus 110. She's a plus 127. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, surprise to me, there to you. 1,042 total votes. 73% Malecki, 84% by decision. For the 27% that have Nunes, 46% by decision, 41% by knockout. I think Josiane Nunes wins a decision in this fight. If she wins the first round, which I think she can, and I think that she can win the second round. So I've got Josiane Nunes. I think this fight's going to decision.
I think you're probably right. But again, in my mind's eye, it is a lot of Nunes moving forward. And when you are the shorter fighter getting in a lot of clinch exchanges with the bigger fighter, all they have to do is pull underhooks, and you're exerting like 9 times the energy they are. Just by them being tall and gravity working against you, it's constantly going to be pulling up on your shoulders and burning your arms out. And again, I hate it when this is the reason that I think a fighter is going to win, but I truly don't believe Mia Malecki is going to go on and have like a Macy Chason type of a career. Like, I truly, like, Macy can beat pretty much anyone in the top 15, right? Like, I understand there's some matchups that are tough for her, but for the most part, she's a good ranked fighter in that division. I think Mia Malecki can win favorable matchups and where her size can really win out, and I think this is going to be one of those fights. Again, I can't disagree with anything that you've said up until this point, but I think the UFC knows what they're doing. She's beaten fighters the similar size of Nunes, who, listen, Nunes I think is more skilled than Veronica Macedo. I guess. So I guess Mia Malecki's going to win this fight. A lot of guessing going on in this prediction.
Matt's got Mia Malecki. I'm going with Brazil's Josiane Nunes. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight. It's a great card. Headline by top 10 middleweights, Jared Cannonier taking on Kelvin Gastelum. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. If you're anything like me, it seems like Brian Kelleher fights every other weekend, but we haven't seen him in about 6 months. He's going to be taking on Son of Fire, Domingo Pilardi. And Matt, I was always under the assumption that it was Pilardi or Pilarte, but I went back and I watched his debut on Dana White's Contender Series, and he said it himself. It's Domingo Pilardi, and he's got an interesting fight coming up at Bantamweight this weekend against a guy who last competed at Featherweight. And it's a little bit of a clash of styles. We talk about Brian Kelleher a lot as being a defensive submission specialist. If you want to see crazy submission, he loves the guillotines. Go watch his fight against Ode Osborne back some time ago. But the craziest thing about this fight, because I had it written down as the old Ryan Reynolds throwback from Harold and Kumar, this is your, but why, fight of the week. But it's not, because these guys were actually supposed to fight in what would have been Domingo Pilardi's UFC debut at UFC 230. Lewis versus Cormier. Now, since then, Brian Kelleher has fought about 6 times. That's absolutely insane. And for Domingo Pilardi, he lost a split decision to Felipe Colares, and then he took on Jurny Newsom, and he got finished really, really quick, and his head bounced off the canvas.
It was gross.
He was knocked out, like, bad, bad. So that fight was about a year and a half ago. The Colares fight was 2 years ago. His last win. And this is where it gets squirrely. He beat Vince Morales by submission on Dana White's Contender Series 3 years ago. Almost 4.5 years ago, he beat Adrian Yanez by split decision. So you go, as a Domingo Pilardi guy, from beating Adrian Yanez and Vince Morales, who, listen, I'm
a good fighter.
I like Vince Morales again. Not to say I didn't before, but he had a great win a couple of weeks ago. To losing to Felipe Colares and Jurny Newsom. I get it, it's a no contest, but listen, that's ridiculous. He lost the fight. For Brian Kelleher, 3-2 in his last 5. But again, if you look at Kelleher's UFC run and the losses, he lost to Cody Stamann, he lost to Ricky Simone, and he can struggle against some wrestlers and some bigger name guys.
So the bantamweight division kind of has like 4 of these fighters who take you down and just kind of throw boxing combinations. Jimmy Rivera is one of those guys. Ricky Simone, I would say, is more wrestling oriented, but he still kind of fits that mold. Cody Stamann, and then at the bottom of that list, I would kind of put Brian Kelleher. Like, he does the same kind of stuff that those guys do. And, well, no, he doesn't go for the same, I guess, volume of takedowns that those guys do. He still is. He's good on the ground, but not great. He's good on the feet, but not great. It's just, Brian Kelleher's got a fun game to watch. It's probably the best way of describing it. He throws everything behind every shot, but we kind of know the limitations of his game. Because it's funny, you bring up UFC 230. So that means that Brian Kelleher would have been coming off the third round knockout loss to John Lineker at UFC 223. I think my memory's right. No, 224, because it was in Brazil. Am I right? I believe
224.
Look at that. So, and after that fight, he did take a lot of damage, and it was interesting, because even I didn't really know where to put Brian Kelleher after that. He was one of those, and I won't say he wasn't a rising star, but he did have a little bit of hype behind him after he beat Hannon Burrow, and that was a huge win back in the day. Like, even a win over 2018 Hannon Burrow means something. It's not 2014, it's definitely not 2013, but it still means something, and he did look really good in that fight. But ever since, I don't really know where to put Brian Kelleher's skill set, because some fights he goes out there, and he looks like he could be a legitimate top 15 talent. He could hurt you on the feet. He's got great power in his shots. And really, when I think about Brian Kelleher, it's such a similarity with the guillotines. Just think of a 10-pound lighter Nick Lentz. They do fight in a very similar manner. Both guys are not afraid to go for volume takedowns when they have to, but they both primarily will try to get done with their boxing. The thing about Brian Kelleher that I do worry about is his susceptibility to leg kicks. I think Domingo can hit him with so many leg kicks, it's not even funny. Because with Brian Kelleher, it's weird. A lot of fighters will eat a lot of leg kicks in one of their fights, and then they will then get that weapon. Brian Kelleher still just eats leg kicks. He still doesn't throw a lot of offensive calf kicks, and I just wonder if that's ever something that he will incorporate into his game. But the huge advantage that Brian Kelleher has coming into this fight is his experience and his strength of schedule. You bring up some of the guys who Domingo Pilardi fought in the past, and they're good fighters. But they're good fighters at early points in their career. Brian Kelleher was in there with prime John Lineker. He was in there with Marlon Vera.
Prime Julio Arce, beating him twice.
Exactly. Like, Brian Kelleher's been in there and done that with some good fighters. I won't throw great next to them, but he's been in there with some really good fighters. So it is hard for me to say, okay, Brian Kelleher, you're not as good as the Cody Stamann the Ricky Simones and the John Linekers of the world. I still think you're better than Domingo Polarte at the end of the day. And for me, it really comes down to, do you think Brian Keller is a top 15 talent kind of guy? Or do you think he always will kind of be in that weird, like, 25 to 15, but he can have a fun fight with just about anybody?
Fringe guy. I mean, you look at it, you look at some of the names that he's been booked against. I mean, that little losing streak. Lineker, Montel Jackson, that was a weird finish. He beats Ode Osborne. He outlasts Hunter Azure's first round, finishes him in the second round back in early 2020. Loses to Cody Stamann, and obviously there were kind of extenuating circumstances around that fight for Cody Stamann, but he went off in that fight and looked amazing. And Brian Kelleher didn't look very good. And then he beats Ray Rodriguez, that just didn't get a great shake in the UFC. And then he loses to Ricky Simone. That was back earlier this year, where he's a plus 200 underdog, which is understandable. But he parlays that into this fight for Domingo Polarte. His last time out about a year and a half ago, he got knocked out cold. And the losses that we talk about for Domingo Polarte, we talk about the wins, but the losses. He lost to Ciao Machado back at Legacy FC 27 in 2014. And then he loses again in 2019. And then he loses again in 2020, and he gets knocked out. So it is a little weird, but he's been off for a very long time. You expect him to be fresh. Coming out of Revolution Dojo and 4-Ounce Fight Club, a name that kind of rings around there that kind of reminds me a little bit of Kelleher, maybe not with the leg kicks, is one really tough out. And you know who I'm talking about. Who is it, Matt?
I'm trying to think.
Who's a guy out of Houston that absolutely bangs in the lower weight classes? Daniel Pineda.
That's true.
4-Ounce Fight Club zone. So when you look at this one, style for style, Domingo Polarte can kind of do everything. Really, really big for this weight class too. Huge advantage in terms of reach, in terms of height. Will that play out as a big difference maker with a much smaller Kelleher?
I think it really could, because that's probably Brian Kelleher. He doesn't throw straight shots. A lot of them are looping. He does rely a lot on that overhand right-left hook combination. But listen, it's a good combination. It's worked for him up until this point. But again, for Kelleher, I think his best path to victory would be shoot for takedowns, mix this up as much as possible, because Brian Kelleher is just a good example of a wrestle boxer. And I understand wrestling might not be at the most forefront of his game, but it is something that he's always got in his back pocket and he's not afraid to use it. I do like Brian Kelleher in this fight, just because for Domingo Polarte, I just don't think he's really progressed that much since he was that fighter on the LFA scene. I still think in large part he does the same kind of stuff, and he hasn't been able to really be consistent enough to prove me otherwise up until this point. Maybe this is the performance that completely changes my mind, but at least for right now, I've got to stick with Brian Kelleher.
Brian Kelleher has a birthday August 19th. It's coming up. Wish him a happy birthday over on the IGs, Matt. Kelleher coming into this fight, minus 140 favorite. He's a minus 174 right now for Domingo Polarte. Open to plus 120s, plus 145. Over on the Tapologies, 1,108 total votes, 88% Kelleher, 30% by decision, 25% by submission, 39% by knockout. There's 12% that have Polarte, 53% by decision. A slim margin either way for the finishes. I like Brian Kelleher due to the volume on the feet. Can he get caught by a long shot? Sure, he can. But I think he can dominate, and we'll see what happens here. But I like Kelleher in this
one. Yeah, no, I agree.
Both of us going with Brian Kelleher to get the win. If you like Domingo Polarte, you want to show him some support, he's a guy that's in need of a win. His last win was 3 years ago over Vince Morales on Contender Series. You let us know that down below in the comments section. If you're loving Fight Night Picks, if you're not, you just tell us what you want.
Yeah.
You can find us on the socials at Fight Night Picks as well. Matt, we got a great card coming up. Cannoneer taking on Gaslam in the co-main event. Mark Madsen taking on Clay Guida. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
I've got this one circled as a possible fight of the night for this weekend at featherweight. We have lights out Austin Lingo making his second start outside of Texas in as many fights. This is a guy that just kept fighting at home. He's going to be taking on Luis Saldana, a guy that finishes more often than not, and I don't know about outside the cage, but this guy is a proven finisher inside of it. This is an absolutely great fight. And for Luis Saldana, we talked extensively about his background before he went into his UFC debut against Jordan Griffin. We're going to throw it back to the 15-minute card breaks rookie review. Then we're going to get it back, talk about Austin Lingo, how this matchup comes together, and offer up a pick and prediction. You're not going to want to miss that rookie review. And And it's an interesting one for Luis Saldana, a guy coming in here at 30. He started his pro career 10 years ago, grinded away in the minor leagues. He's got an overall record of 14-6. He's like the Yermin Mercedes of MMA. And listen, the hit streak couldn't continue for Mercedes, but it could for Saldana in this fight. He's got a really interesting one ahead of him. And if you look at his overall body of work, all of those 14 wins are by finish. That's absolutely insane. Six by knockout, eight by submission. A guy coming at us from Fight Ready MMA in Arizona. And we've talked about Fight Ready before, and we're going to talk about Fight Ready even more with Santino DeFranco. And he's training with Kamuela Kirk, and I think that's really going to help him in a fight like this. Take on a guy in Jordan Griffin. For Luis Saldana, he can definitely get the submission. Again, eight of his overall 14 wins by submission. His overall level of competition, not as high as that of a Jordan Griffin. I mean, we're talking losses to Mike Santiago. Yes, that guy that fought in the UFC that time back in 2016. But if you look at the recent win streak for Luis Saldana, four in a row, he had that Carl Whitstock win that looks great from LFA 60. Took some time off, and then fought Vince Murdoch on Contender Series. And it was a weird one, because Murdoch was a guy, he already had a contract, he was supposed to fight in the UFC. Do you know he's supposed to fight in the UFC?
Who?
Jordan Griffin. He was supposed to fight Jordan Griffin in Milwaukee. It didn't happen. Murdoch had that weird health scare, and then these guys fought. And Luis Saldana bodied him up, and pieced him up, and finished him with an insane front kick, and then just pounded away. Well, he basically was sitting on his face. I wish I never said that on this channel, but I did. And then he just hammered away in his face. Luis Saldana, triple threat. Love the fight. This is a good one. So recently, the judges are a big bone of contention for a lot of people. I thought Ty Gwerder beat Haji Bestayev over with Bellator. You probably thought that Clay Collard beat Haush Manfiel over with the PFL last week. And we had picks and predictions on those. But Matt, for Luis Saldana's last fight out, I had Jordan Griffin to win. You had Luis Saldana to win. And Matt, the referees that we had in that fight, Adelaide Bird, Derek Cleary, and who was it? Junichiro Kanijo. There were 29-28s for Luis Saldana, and he ended up winning that fight over Jordan Griffin. That one was by unanimous decision. The votes over on MMA decisions.
Don't even get me started.
Two people had 29-28 Saldana. 16 had it 29-28 Griffin. For Luis Saldana, he got taken down a lot, and Jordan Griffin really pressured him, but he gets an opportunity to right the ship here. I know it's a win, and he's on a lovely win streak, but an opportunity to really kind of prove the naysayers wrong. He's taking on a really tough fighter in Austin Lingo at a Fortis MMA, and there's a lot of reasons why I love this fight. What makes you so excited for this one?
Why are we saying that Luis Saldana had a really close fight against a super good veteran in his UFC debut? Because that's honestly the way that you should look at it. I know he got taken down, but this is the problem.
Super good.
Jordan Griffin's a good litmus test for a lot of guys coming into the UFC. We were talking about before how Max Griffin is way too much. He's too hot on the Goldilocks standard.
On the level of Griffin's, Max is up here.
Max
and Jordan's
is at the top.
In the middle.
Jordan's a pretty good UFC debut. And
where's
for Luis
Blake?
You gotta stop. For Blake Griffin, he was a former All-Star and now has no knees. For Luis Saldana, yeah, he got taken down by Jordan Griffin, but that is to be expected against a guy like Jordan Griffin. And honestly, it was one of those close fights that could have gone either way. It was a split decision, I kind of thought it was.
Unanimous.
And I thought Jordan Griffin was probably going to walk away with a split decision by the time that fight was over. But Luis Saldana did get work done on the feet when he was able to keep it there. And that really is the thing for Luis Saldana. If you look at his record, he does have knockouts. He does have submission wins. But it's a term that we use a lot on this channel. You have defensive submissions and you have offensive submissions. With Luis Saldana, it is a bit of a mix of both. But with Saldana, it is either you make a mistake or I rock you and then I'm going to submit you. It's never he's going like Damian Maia. I'm going to try to single leg you up against the cage and then walk to your back. It is a very fun style that he does incorporate. And again, if Luis Saldana is a guy who can get on a bit of a streak, I'm sure he will gain a lot of fans just due to his fight style. Even go back, I apologize for the opponent's name, but the fight he won on Contender Series by front kick was absolutely disgusting. And that really is the
thing.
Vince Murdoch. My apologies, Vince. But Luis Saldana is one of those unique fighters who has really good attacks going up the middle. It's something we talked about with Ignacio Bahamondes, for instance, how he likes to throw those uppercuts up the middle. It comes a lot more natural to Luis Saldana. He has a lot more knees coming up the middle, a lot more elbows and whatnot. The comparison for Luis Saldana that I always think of. Now, again, I think this fighter is much better than Luis Luis Saldana, but at least the sort of bare bones of his game, it's kind of Dan Hooker-ish, to where he does like to keep you at range. He will invest in the leg kicks. When you do try to close distance, he's using that knee a lot, and a lot of his submission wins do come from them being defensive. Even look at the Mark Giacchese fight. Like, Dan Hooker submitted Mark Giacchese. That's kind of wild, but it was. It was just a guillotine after Giacchese crashed forward. With Saldana, though, the wrestling defense is just going to be the issue throughout his whole entire UFC debut. And against Austin Lingo, who he will play that kind of, listen, I'm going to go in there and throw bombs kind of game. But I still think Austin Lingo is the better wrestler in this fight overall. And this fight for me just comes down to game plans more than anything. If Austin Lingo's coach sits him down and says, hey, Austin, put the wrestling shoes on. We're just going in there shooting double legs off a crashing forward. Then I think he could win this fight. But I do really worry about Lingo, at least with his output on the feet in this one. Because Saldana is a guy who will stay active a lot on those in-betweens. He's not somebody who the commentary will say gets caught looking in the mirror. So I do think that if this fight is at distance and if Lingo's not the one crashing forward, I do think Saldana can get good work done at range.
Yeah, and I think it's a great fight. And the reason being, Luis Saldana can be defensively sound enough with his back up against the cage. This is a guy that before beating Jordan Griffin, no matter how controversially you want to say it was, every other win was by finish. That was his first decision win. And even in the fight against Jordan Griffin, where there's a threat of getting taken down, and he did, because Griffin went 4 of 7 for his total takedown attempts and mounted 6 minutes and 18 seconds of control time. 25% of Saldana's strikes in that fight were to the leg. That's a no-no against a guy that can wrestle, and he was able to do it. Now, again, did he win? Did he not win? Well, it's a W in the win column, so that's where I'll leave it. But for Austin Lingo, he struggled against a longer fighter in his UFC debut, which, again, was his first fight outside of Texas. I can't stress that enough. He was 7-0 coming into the UFC. He was a favorite against Yusuf Zalal. I sent a message to Nolan King. I said, Nolan, I need dirt. Who have you got in this one? And he gave me a pretty good case for Yusuf Zalal. People thought I was crazy going Zalal, but I did. And then I had to reevaluate Austin Lingo when he went into his last fight. Well, what did he do when he took on Jacob Kilburn? Well, Jacob Kilburn had a rough go in the UFC.
Jacob Kilburn's not great.
He bounced him from the UFC, and now we end up with an Austin Lingo that looked good in that fight, but he's got a really tough opponent, and I can say that, against a guy like Saldana. But he's been great with his takedown attempts. Zalal did get 6 of them against Lingo, but at the time, it was just an odd fight. And for Lingo over Jacob Kilburn, the numbers might be close. Go back and watch that fight. There were 230-26s. He looked amazing.
He did look really good in that fight. But this is the problem. Austin Lingo isn't going to show up to this fight and just shoot double-A takedowns. It's not in his nature. I really doubt in one training camp his corner's been able to say, hey, you're going to go from getting taken down and going like one takedown in 15 minutes to now we're going to start shooting 4 to 5 takedowns per 15 minutes, because you don't really understand the other consequences that that has on his overall game. If he is then focusing on takedowns, well, that means he's going to get more tired earlier on in the fight. That all, yes, he could get the takedowns, but again, Austin Lingo is not somebody like Chad Mendes who's been wrestling his whole entire life. Like, it's going to fatigue him more the more he does wrestle. And with Lingo, again, he is going to have the advantage. I just don't think that's something he's going to be able to use over and over again. I could see him winning one round, maybe one round being close because of the wrestling, but I really do feel like Saldana at range with those leg kicks, and again, with just his distance strikes overall, I do like Saldana in this fight. I do understand the hesitancy, at least, after his last performance against Jordan Griffin, but when a UFC debuting fighter is against a guy like Jordan Griffin, I think probably 20% higher of Jordan Griffin than most people do, but I think Jordan Griffin is a great first test in the UFC, and I think that's a performance that you can at least build upon.
The odds, a little strange. Saldana opened the favorite minus 130. The line went all the way to a minus 168. It's worked back up to a minus 132, and it's been a gradual climb for Austin Lingo. He opened at a plus 110. You could have had him at a plus what? 138? He's a plus 108 right now. So recently, Lingo's gained in terms of the odds. Topology votes, over under. What are we saying? I'm saying probably over 60% Saldana. You think?
Yeah, I'd say that. I'll say 50% say finish, no?
1,069 total votes, 78% Saldana, 78% by decision for the 22% that have Lingo, 63% by decision. I think it's going to go to decision too, and I think it's going to be another chintzy call like Saldana's last fight.
I think Saldana, If anybody gets a finish in this fight, though, it will be Saldana, because I think he's the much more damaging striker. And again, what Saldana does in his strikes, they do accumulate over time. This is the thing. If you think this fight's going to go late, that means you think that Saldana's going to land 20 leg kicks. I don't think Austin Lingo's a guy who can absorb that kind of damage to the leg. And again, those are the things that are going to accumulate as the fight progresses. So for me, I do like Saldana in this one. I think this fight could be very close. And I do think both guys are going to go on and have fairly good futures in the UFC. It's just that ever so slightly I have to pick Saldana.
You want to see a disgusting finish, and you want to talk about a guy that has knockout power. Austin Lingo has that power to absolutely put your lights out with one shot. It's a Solo Hadley Jr. fight. He flatlines him early, and that's all she wrote. It's good night, Irene, like Michael Chiavello would say. I really like the game of Austin Lingo. This is one that I'm going to kind of hum and haw on all week. I've got it as a 50-50 on my notes. I like Luis Saldana for his defensive abilities up against the cage. For those reasons, I like him just because I've seen that matchup where Lingo took on a guy that had those abilities, can move side to side like a Yusuf Zalal and defend some of the takedowns. Now, having said that, at the start of the video, Saldana wasn't able to do a lot against Jordan Griffin, so we'll see what he's been able to do.
He also had 2.5 minutes of control time.
With Santino DeFranco, Eddie Cha, and the guys over at Fight Ready MMA. I mean, a great team over there. Did he get any time with the Korean Zombie? I don't know, but there's all sorts of great training partners over there. We're both siding with Phoenix's own Luis Saldana in this fight. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Is it Lingo? Is it Saldana? We got a great card coming
up
this
weekend. It's one of our Fight of the Night nominees.
It should be great. You're not going to want to miss those videos. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
From Fight Night Picks, consider supporting the channel by utilizing the super thanks. All you have to do down below the video, you toss in a little bit of bonus, you buy yourself an animated super thanks, and they will post the following public comment on your behalf. All sorts of different options out there. We'd certainly appreciate the support with the channel. You guys are definitely the best fans in all of MMA, and we appreciate each and every one of you and hope that you definitely enjoy this weekend's card between Jared Cannonier and Calvin Gastelum. All sorts of great matchups littered throughout. We appreciate the continued support of the channel and the boys. Thanks so much. Without further ado, let's get into it. For Trevin Jones' sake, hopefully a fight happens this weekend. Matt, we have five-star Trevin Jones representing Guam, taking on Uzbekistan Said Yakub Kakrakmanov. Matt, I absolutely love this fight. And when I read this afternoon that on short notice, Said Yakub Kakrakmanov was coming into the UFC, I texted you, and you knew that I was excited about it because I got so excited.
He's good.
He's so good, and I go back to when he fought Umar Nurmagomedov. Now, when Umar Nurmagomedov made his UFC debut, I had like 3 pages of notes getting excited for his fight against Sergey Morozov. And I studied frame by frame his fight with Said Yakub Kakrakmanov because it was one of those one-off PFL like showcase fights that they used to have. You haven't really seen as many of them this year. But for Kakrakmanov, he was 22 years old. He was still green. He had no losses on his record. You go in, you lose a decision to Umar Nurmagomedov. That's fine. He beats Georgi Kukudashvili over with ROC, Ring of Combat. He loses to Pipe Vargas, who's a really good fighter. And then he takes some time off. He beats Askar Askar, who was undefeated. He beats Tyson Lynn over with CFFC at the start of this year, wins their vacant Bantamweight Championship, and boom, goes to Dynamite. There's been interviews out there with Said Yakub where he said, hey, hopefully that springboards me into a Dana White's Contender Series opportunity. And maybe, just maybe, I get a UFC call-up. Well, he gets his wish. He's going to be taking on Trevin Jones. And these are the opponents that Trevin Jones has lost in the last month. Tony Kelly, that was supposed to be a fight. Aaron Phillips, that was supposed to be a fight. And the list goes on and on because Ronnie Lawrence, that was going to be a fight. And then for this week, it's supposed to be Manny Martinez, who also pulled out. Within a month, he's lost those 4 fights. Now, it's not that nobody wants to fight Trevin Jones. It's just unfortunate circumstances. He's won 4 fights in a row against Mehdi Baidulayev. He beat Takafumi Otsuka. Then he had the fight against Timur Valiyev where he knocked him out, but he tested positive for the weed. And then he knocks out Mario Bautista. So really in this fight, Trevin Jones is a guy that I thought was going to have a bad UFC run. Didn't throw a lot in combination.
I called you out because of it.
Didn't throw a lot in combination through a power jab where he kind of baited Timur Valiyev in. Valiyev was a huge favorite in that fight. Against Mario Bautista, I had Bautista to win. I thought he was more well-rounded. And out of all the tape study that I did on Trevin Jones, this is a guy that's fought with so many different organizations, but It was the fight in deep where he took on Takafumi Otsuka. Jones is a guy where he gets backed up against the cage. It's almost like he gets lazy. He doesn't really do a whole lot. He gets taken down. His wrestling didn't look great. His grappling didn't look great. Then he comes to UFC and he looks amazing. He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's been training extensively between Extreme Couture and Drysdale's jiu-jitsu with the likes of Max Roshkoff and Robert Drysdale, but a lot of great guys over there. Trevin Jones all of a sudden has blossomed into this star. And now for Said Yakub Kakrakmanov, you get an opportunity to steal some of the thunder. He's only 25. And for Said Yakub, what's he good at? Effing everything.
He is a really well-rounded MMA fighter, and this is the only thing I will say. The UFC is kind of doing him a disservice right now. I feel like on Tuesday Night Contender Series, he would be able to have one of those showcase performances where he is a minus 600 favorite, kind of like what we've seen in a lot of those cases on Dana White's Contender Series.
He could be your next O'Malley. He could be your next Melzik Bogdazarian. He could be a special fighter. This is tricky.
Exactly, and I don't think you say the O'Malley name to say he could be that level of a star, but he could have that level of success in the UFC, and that really is the thing. His skill set does shine. He's a great striker. He's got good kicks. He does have the wrestling too if he really needs to go down to it. Like, he took down Nurmagomedov in their fight. That tells you all you need to know about him. The problem is you're fighting Trevin Jones on like 4 days notice, and at the end of the day, that does have to be taken into consideration. Trevin Jones is an interesting fighter, and I always go back to what Jorge Masvidal said after he went away for that year on the island and knocked out Darren Till. When you look at Jorge Masvidal, a lot of his losses were split decision fights. They were fights that weren't really close, but you could tell that it was almost like he'd get out to a lead, and then he would kind of take his foot off the gas pedal. He would become kind of lazy in his fights, for lack of a better term. I think Trevin Jones is very similar to that. I feel like with Trevin Jones, it is a mentality thing over than a skill set issue, because when you do look at him, when he is moving forward, when he is throwing in combination, defending takedowns, like, he looks legit, and he does look like he could be, and again, it's hard to say with this division, 135 is so good, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if in 8 months' time, Trevin Jones had a number next to his name, and that's why this sucks so bad for Kakrakmanov. We've seen this at least recently. There's been fighters who come in on short notice, and they're able to win by that one quick flash knockout. The issue is that I've seen Trevin Jones get dropped by Timur Valiyev, and he was still able to come back and win that fight, and I understand a lot of people might look at that as, oh, he might be susceptible to shots to the body. That's one of those cases where, like, at a certain point, you have to see a fighter go through adversity and see how they're going to react to it. Some fighters don't react well to it at all. Trevin Jones got up, fought his way back into that fight, and was able to knock out a borderline top 15 guy now after his win over Hany Barcelos. Like, Trevin Jones deserves some of those borderline top 15 guys, I believe, and that's why this is such a disservice to Kakrakmanov. It really does remind me of Brahimi versus Max Griffin with Brahimi's UFC debut.
When I look at this fight, so for Trevin Jones, like, full transparency, we've done one video, got ready for three, so I'm going to give you my picks. I think he would have beat Tony Kelly. I think he would have beat Aaron Phillips. I picked Ronnie Lawrence to win. You picked Trevin Jones.
Thought Trevin would have won.
And I thought he would have beat Manny Martinez, who's a quick finisher, but more of a same deal, like a Contender Series guy.
The Lawrence fight would have been great.
The Lawrence fight was great. I think this fight is also great. Like, again, I'm very excited. I think Said Yakub Kakrakmanov is a great UFC prospect. So when I look at this one, it's yikes. The weird thing, too, for Kakrakmanov, he beat Askar Askar. He took that O. He finished him in under a minute. And then Askar won a fight. And then they booked him against Cody Stamann in the UFC. They said, you know, couldn't pass medicals, whatever it was. And Askar Askar's, you know, going to have to build his way back up. Maybe he ends up on Contender Series. But for Kakrakmanov, again, gets that big win over with CFFC. He beat Tyson Lin, and you might go, okay, well, Tyson Lin's record, not that great. The names that Tyson Lin lost to, Sean O'Malley, Journey Newson, and Luis Smolka, and the Newson and Smolka fights were back-to-back. So he took on great competition outside of the UFC. Kakrakmanov looked amazing. Took him down really early, got on top, implemented his game, ends up with the finish. So I really do like it. The other thing with Kakrakmanov, trains at a Team Oyama with Luis Smolka and the gang. Colin Oyama, and I say it every time I get the opportunity to, one of the more underrated coaches in MMA, and we don't hear enough about him.
No, we really don't. Like, he is one of those guys who does not get the spotlight for some odd reason. But again, at the end of the day, it's hard to pick against Trevin Jones. Like, he's done enough in his only two UFC fights to prove that he deserves at least a borderline top 15 guy. And again, I don't think Trevin Jones should go in there and fight Sean O'Malley tomorrow. Probably be a great fight. But I do think he is deserving of some of those guys who do have a bigger name value. Because for Kakrakmanov, again, this is a huge disservice to him. You already brought it up. the Tuesday Contender Series would have almost been perfect for him. You could have built him up a little bit more. You could have told his story and explained some of his wins outside the UFC. And then you could have given him, and I hate to say an underhand toss, because there are upsets in Dana White Contender Series. But, you know, they make those fights for a reason. The odds are very, there's rarely pick'em odds, let's just say that. So, for me, I guess I'll still pick Trevin Jones. But again, I do think Kakrimanov is going to be longer than just a one-and-done kind of guy in the UFC. I think this might be one blimp on the radar. And then I think after this, it should be smooth sailing.
So we're making this video on the same day and afternoon. Well, I guess this fight was announced in the afternoon. We're at night now, getting ready for this one. No odds on it yet. Topology votes sparse. 176 total votes, 81% Jones, 80% by knockout for the 19% that have Kakrimanov, 62% by decision, 29% by knockout. I think if Kakrimanov is going to have success in this one, it's not with the hands, because he's the type of guy that can switch stance, throw a good jab to close distance, and take the fight to the mat. He could have success in wrestling with Jones with his top pressure. Jones, again, with sneaky jiu-jitsu on the mat. There's a lot of things that I like out of Jones where he baits guys in. And Saeed Yacoub can overextend himself a little bit. There's a great opportunity for Jones. So I'm ever so slightly going with Jones, but when I see the odds come out for this one, I would not be surprised if Jones is in the range of like a minus 250 to a minus 300 favorite.
I think I'm still pissed off that they say Timur Valiyev's on like a 19-fight win streak.
That's a lie.
Yeah, exactly. It's a huge lie.
It's a lie.
Exactly. Trevin Jones, he should be on a 2-fight winning streak in the UFC, and I think he'll be able to get done this weekend.
Both of us going with Trevin Jones, the other grain of salt. This guy's had 4 different opponents to get ready for.
At least he's been in the gym, though. And again, that is the important thing. I would much rather Trevin Jones having different opponents but staying in the gym than a guy coming in on a week's notice.
And the Ronnie Lawrence one, a decent comp. Both of us going with Trevin Jones, but I do, honest to goodness, think that Saeed Yacoub Kakrimanov has a great opportunity in this one. If you like him, let us know down below in the comments section. Likewise for Guams, Trevin Jones. Matt, I love this card. Great fights coming up. The Carpenter taking on the Olympian. Ooh. And in the main event, Cannonier vs. Gastelum. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. So up here in Canada, there's a commercial that plays all the time and it doesn't stop. It's about LG stacked washer dryer. And there's an older lady, there's a guy with a baby, and then there's another lady. And they're singing, hey, dirty, baby, I got your laundry. And I see it all the time. I don't even watch a lot of television. But all that being said, I watch that commercial and I go, man, I wonder if the people that are watching this actually know how that song goes with ODB. And then right at the start, it's bad. Now, Shimmy Shimmy Ya, Shimmy Ya, and Shimmy Yay, give me the mic so I can take it away. That's a different song. But one other ODB song is Ooh Baby, I Like It Raw. And we've got Raw Dog, Brandon Royval, making his re-entry to the Ultimate Fighting Championship, taking on the cannibal Alessandro Pantoja. Matt, who can't get up for this one?
I'm so excited.
The Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night. I would throw my notes, but for this one, I have odds and that's it, because that's how excited I am for this one. But I had to go back because for Brandon Royval, he was in a title eliminators last time out. He took on Brandon Moreno. That was a lot of fun. It was like, hey, is it going to be one of these two guys? Is Alex Perez going to be able to get it done against Deiveson Figueiredo? Newsflash, no.
Not at all.
So for Brandon Royval, having a little success in that first round, and then he didn't. And then he had a big issue in terms of an injury. The interview that he did with friend of the show, Nolan King, with MMA Junkie, this was from quite a while ago. So the outlook is looking like surgery at this point, Royval recently revealed to MMA Junkie. I have a torn labrum and I chipped some bones away through repetitive damage of having that torn labrum. It's looking like surgery at this point, which is really unfortunate. If you look at it for Brandon Royval, he's been out for a lot of time, 8 months and 3 weeks, so call it 9 months. He had won in an absolute knock him out, drag him out fight just a few months before that against Kai Kara France. And for Alessandro Pantoja, guy that a lot of people have a hard time capping just where he fits in this division. We all know he's a top 10 guy.
Top 5.
But can he be that guy? Can he beat somebody right up there at the tippity top? You look at it in the 5 on in. He beat Wilson Hayes.
Knocked him
out. He lost to Figueiredo. He beat Matt Schnell. He lost to Askar Askarov. Close enough fight, would you say?
It was.
And then he beat Manel Kopp in a fight where, hey, Manel, just show up. Just show up, and Manel decided not to. And then finally, a few weeks ago, when he missed weight, he did show up. But for Pantoja, He can kind of play your game, which scares you when he takes on a lot of guys, but he's got great power. If he needs to play the volume game, he can. He's one of the more well-rounded flyweights you're going to find, and that's why this guy's had such longevity in the UFC, and he's still only 31, which is crazy because he's had 28 pro fights. For Brandon Royval, again, you look at some of the losses, we're talking really big names. You look at him coming into the UFC, neither one of us thought he was going to have a lot of success.
No.
I know I can say that personally, but we said that before we started filming. He beats Tim Elliott back some time ago, start of 2020, beats Kai Kara France, almost gets to the top. And then he couldn't. But again, those losses. Casey Kenney, Nick Urso, Ricky Palacios. Like, big names. Ben Von Bauer.
Wow.
Big names. But that was back in 2012. Can Brandon Royval come back from a torn labrum in 9 months? We're going to find out.
It's going to be really interesting. And again, people know I love basketball. And I'm going to sound like the Rain Man right now. Because I know basketball injuries. Paul George had that happen to him. But he had it on both shoulders. Paul George went from being a borderline MVP player in the NBA. And I'm just going to say this right now. If you're a borderline MVP player in the NBA, you're a much better athlete than the majority of people in MMA. It's just the truth. Where the money is where the top level athletes go. That's why guys in the NFL who weigh like 300 pounds and don't look athletic can run like a 5'4", or can run like a 4'5", 40.
What are you saying about like Connor McDavid and Shohei Ohtani?
They're really good athletes too. No. I'm just saying like MLB hockey, like, the major four North American sports are normally where you find the highest level athletes. And the fact that there was a guy who was a borderline MVP who then came back after a shoulder surgery, he averaged like 18 points per game for a month after that. And that's good, don't get me wrong. But when you're averaging 27 playing for OKC and then you're down to 18 playing for the Clippers, I get it, different systems and whatnot. But the injury had something to do with it. And that's the big problem with injuries, is that it takes you a little bit of time of in-competition action to finally get comfortable with that injury again. Like, Brandon Royval, he could spar 1,000 rounds in the gym. He could roll for hours on end. But he's never going to get that same in-cage feeling. Nobody you spar with is going to try to hit you as hard as Alessandro Pantoja is going to. Because that's the thing about Pantoja. It's like Deiveson Figueiredo is probably the best knockout threat in this division. And right behind him, and I mean right behind him, it is Pantoja. He has that kind of power at this weight division. Go back and watch his fight against Matt Schnell. Like, Matt Schnell can strike a little bit, and it was disgusting. Matt Schnell cracks him with one good shot. Pantoja's like, oh, I have to try in the striking now. Flatlines with an overhand. And that really is the type of fighter that you're worrying about when you fight a guy like Pantoja. And it brings you back to one attribute of Brandon Royval's that I don't like. Because I can admit it, coming into the UFC, I defined him by that Casey Kenney loss. I thought, hey, he'll never become a better fighter than the guy who got out-wrestled by Casey Kenney. The thing I never took into consideration, though, was now him fighting smaller guys to where he can scramble with them now on their takedown attempts is making him that much more effective. Like, look at the Tim Elliott fight. Tim Elliott, I'm sure, is a better pure wrestler than Brandon Royval. Brandon Royval doesn't care anymore. He's letting you take him down just to initiate the scramble because he realizes that the real grappling doesn't start till after both you guys hit the mat. And that's what's going to be interesting in this fight because Brandon Royval, I'm sure, can strike with Pantoja. I don't think it's his best path to victory, and I think if this is just a kickboxing fight, then Pantoja probably wins it 9 times out of 10. On the mats where it's going to be tricky, though, because I'll be honest, I think Pantoja's striking is like a 9.5 out of 10, and I feel comfortable putting it that high on the scale. His grappling could be anywhere from like a 3 to an 8.5, because with Pantoja, defensively, he does have some trouble against some really good wrestlers. He does get held down sometimes, but then you look at him in other fights where, even in the Askar-Askarov fight, like, Askar takes him down, but then he can kind of out-grapple him once they hit the mat. It's, for me, I know how good Pantoja is on the feet, and I don't doubt his skills on the mat. It's just that's where my question marks lie in his game, I guess.
Pantoja's been out for about 6 months since he beat Manel Kopp. That was Kopp's debut. Again, when you talk about Askar Askarov,
they had a great fight.
That guy's an amazing fighter. He's an absolute sambo freak, and I thought...
And his striking's good.
Yeah, I thought he should have been the next guy to get a shot at the title, but who knows? But when we look at all of the fights, for Pantoja to be competitive in those exchanges, Royval is a power grappler. Like, this guy can sink anything up on the mat, and he's an amazing fighter. And yes, can sometimes he fight Jerome Rivera, who falls backwards and breaks his arm? Maybe. But for Brandon Royval, a really good strength of schedule as well. Obviously not as many fights, obviously not all in the UFC. The thing that makes this very interesting, Pantoja opened a minus 125 favorite. He's a minus 171 right now. I want to hear from you down below in the comment section if you think that's crazy. Because for Royval, open a plus 105. He's now at a plus 142. And Matt, before we go into the Tapology votes, I feel like those opening lines, if you considered everything equal, no injuries, I think that makes sense.
I do too, but the... I gotta be honest, I think Pantoja's better than Royval in quite a few areas. I really do. This is my problem with Brandon Royval. If Kai Kara-France can drop you in their fight, Pantoja's gonna knock you out if he lands clean. I understand Kai Kara-France is a crisp striker, and people love Ocean City Kickboxing. His striking so good. His striking's not as good as Alessandro Pantoja's. Like, he doesn't throw the leg kicks Pantoja does. He doesn't have the power Pantoja does. Like,
ask Rogerio Bonterin.
That's fine, but if Bonterin ever got in a cage with Pantoja, he's getting flatlined. There, even after what happened in the Kyler Phillips fight, I feel comfortable saying that. I understand where the odds are, and again, I really do feel like the game of Brandon Royval is going to rely on those scrambles. If they get into scrambles and he ends up on top, then I do think he can out-grapple Pantoja. The issue is that if they get into a scramble and he does end up on bottom, Pantoja hit one of the hardest sweeps you can possibly hit on Askar Askarov. He went for a single leg, went through his legs, and then took his back in the first round. And Askar Askarov is an absurd grappler. Like, he was in there going, like, move for move with a guy like Brandon Moreno. Like, that tells you how good of a grappler he is. Now, in the end, Askar Askarov did win out in those wrestling exchanges against Pantoja, but I don't think Brandon Royval has the same physical strength factor that Askar Askarov does.
Some would say that Alessandro Pantoja was able to flow like water. Matt, 1,163 total votes on Tapology. 62% have Pantoja, 78% by decision for the 38% that have Royval. 43% by decision, 40% by submission. Injuries always scare me, and maybe I put too much into them. Again, like a torn labrum in baseball, you're out for a long time. Now again, whether you're a pitcher, whether you're a fielder, it all depends, but still, that's a really long time. Royval's been out for 9 months. I get it. Who do we have on the channel that was out of Factory X that trained with Brandon Royval? There were different fighters, but still, the point was, this guy has an opportunity to come right back in, settle the score, okay, and reintroduce himself to the top five of this division and really make a mark. Royval wins this fight. We're talking the Askarovs. We're talking those elite, elite fighters. Maybe even a Figueiredo.
And this is what I have to say about this fight, and this will be the last point from me. We had said before we even started recording, and then you brought it up, how I think this should be the main event. Like, I really do think skill for skill, these guys are better than Jared Cannonier and Kelvin Gastelum. Kelvin Gastelum, no one knows if he's 1 foot in or 1 foot out right now. Jared Cannonier, yeah, he got the, like, break speed off by Robert Whittaker, but that's going to happen to a lot of guys. I really do think that Pantoja and Royval could realistically find themselves in a title fight by the end of next year, depending on how this fight goes. Like, the winner wins this, then you probably fight, like, maybe Askarov. Now, you would assume Askarov probably gets Moreno next, unless they do the trilogy with Figueiredo, but you understand, like, these are those top five names of the flyweight division, and I'm gonna say this. Whoever wins this deserves a main event. They do. Flyweight division needs more main events. The last one that I can remember that was a fight night main event was Brandon Moreno versus Sergio Pettis. And that was a phenomenal fight back in the day. And that was before either guy even really got into their prime. And it was still a phenomenal fight.
Before they both became champions.
Exactly. So you're telling me that you wouldn't watch Brandon Royval and Pantoja fight for an extra 10 minutes?
Give us the 5 rounds, Matt. Exactly. In this fight, I've got Alessandro Pantoja. I have the injury question marks. I get it. Brandon Royval hits hard. He's great in scrambles. His jiu-jitsu is amazing. He's a great fighter in this division. I just like the well-roundedness of Pantoja. A little bit of the volume, too. And for those reasons, I've got American Top Team's own Alessandro Pantoja.
I do, too. But again, this is Fight of the Night without a doubt. Like, we didn't even talk about what was going to be on the Fight of the Night screen before Craig was like, well, it's Pantoja and Royval, and then we'll figure out the next one. Like, this is how good this fight is going to be.
Absolutely love it, both of us going with Brazil's Pantoja. Let us know down below if you've got Royval, if you've got Pantoja. I know you've got in that main event, Cannonier taking on Gastelum. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Straight up, this is one of the hardest fights to try and figure out. On this card at lightweight, we have Vince from Hell Pichel taking on Austin Thud Hubbard. And if you look at it for Austin Hubbard, out of the fights in the UFC, it's weird, right? You remember the fight where he had, what do they properly call it? Like compression syndrome in his leg, oh, where you kind of got to cut it open every now and again. But you look at some of the losses. He loses to Davi Hamosh, who can grapple and wrestle. He loses to Mark Madsen, who's in the co-main event this weekend. Well, he's
an
pretty
Olympian.
Good at wrestling. He won a silver medal at the Olympics. And then he lost to Joe Selecki, who can grapple and wrestle. And in those fights, it was tricky because in the other fights that he's in, he's a comeback king. He probably goes into the second or third round. He's like, coach, I'm good. Let me stand up. Or I'll do the Alexei Olenek where I sit my butt down and you hold my feet up.
The sign of great cardio.
Get some, you got to get the blood flowing back in your loins. You got to get ready for it. But for Austin Hubbard, he's probably like, hey, I'm good, coach. I'm ready to go. This is where it kicks in. Just like a Sasha Plotnikov. Because for Hubbard, in the fight against Kyle Prepelec, boom, we're back. In the fight against Max Roshkov, lost the first round, won the second round, and then he goes out there and beats Dakota Bush. And we said, getting ready for that one, Bush was oddly one of the more game opponents that I think could kind of pick away at some of the issues that Austin Hubbard has in the cage. Well, I think Vince Pichel kind of does a lot of that, and he checks a lot of those boxes. And for Vince Pichel, the big thing for me, this is a guy that he's out of Simi Valley in California. He's always pretty well trained in California. But then I went to his Instagram, and, you know, when you're looking at a 38-year-old's Instagram, it's kind of a weird bucket of muscles.
Probably family photos, I'd assume.
It's a mixed bag. For Vince, he's posting pictures where now he's training at the rival gym because Hubbard's been at Elevation for some time. And Vince Pichel's now at Factory X. So I'm wondering, with Vince Pichel, if you're training with a guy like, I don't know, say Alexander Hernandez, how do you get ready for a fight like this against Austin Hubbard where style for style they match up well, Pichel wrestles well, and just look what he did to Jim Miller's last time out.
He did look really good against Jim Miller, and I feel like that performance is kind of an outlier for Vince Pichel because up until that point, he never really had the upper level of competition in his career. I understand the Gregor Gillespie fight is a bit of an outlier, but
Joaquim Silva was good back then.
I like Joaquim Silva, and I'm definitely in the minority on that. There's like three people out there. Like, he had a fun career, but I wouldn't say Joaquim Silva's the hill to die on. It was just for Vince Pichel. He was always kind of fighting the same level of fighters, but he would keep on winning, and that was just kind of it.
Long layoffs.
Exactly. And then he finally did get that upper echelon guy against Gregor Gillespie, and you could tell it was just a step too far, because Vince Pichel, he does fight a little bit like Ally Quinta, to where, like, I've got good stand-up, but my stand-up's only good if you're a primary wrestler, and my wrestling's good, but, like, against other wrestlers, I myself can kind of get out-wrestled, and that's what we saw against Gregor Gillespie in that fight. He just never could get his striking going against Gillespie, and then once Gillespie was dedicated to those takedowns, you could tell that Pichel, A, just being at such an advanced age, he just couldn't really keep up with the younger Gregor Gillespie. His last two times out, though, against Roosevelt Roberts, listen, if you're gonna beat Roosevelt Roberts, that's how you're gonna beat him. You're gonna take him down, and that was the start of kind of like, hey.
What's the provincial and state park called?
Roosevelt.
Exactly. Got him.
I thought John Anik always said Roosevelt. My bad. So for Roosevelt Roberts, again, I felt like that fight very much was a stylistic. It was a very favorable matchup for Vince Pichel because all it was I get to shoot takedowns and throw power punches on the outside. And that's pretty much his bread and butter. This fight, more than any, does come down to cardio. And I know that's a bit of a cop-out because we say this all the time with Austin Hubbard fights. But, like, his cardio's that good. If fights for 10 rounds, Austin Hubbard's record would not be 13-5.
I'm going to tell you this. I'm talking to you. If you're in your car, if you're on the airplane, if you're hanging out, studying tape at home, go back and watch Austin Hubbard when he fights Mark Madsen. Now, Mark Madsen's in your co-main event. We're going to talk about him soon. Mark Madsen has an issue with third rounds, and Austin Hubbard beat an Olympic silver medalist with his defensive wrestling and his cardio in just the third round.
And the good thing about Austin Hubbard, too, was we were talking about Bea Malecki, is to where she's good at striking with range, but then once you do get on the inside, she just kind of struggle. Austin Hubbard gets a lot of his work done at range, but when guys do collapse that distance on him, he does have good attacks going up the middle. He does have a really good flying knee. He does have just good knees in general, and that was something you started to see in that Marco Madsen fight was, okay, as Madsen gets a little bit more tired, that's when Hubbard was pulling it on. But the other thing you have to bring up is that Austin Hubbard is good at avoiding damage on the mat. I know he's been submitted, and Joe Selecki's a really, really good grappler, so it's going to happen. But at least when he does get taken down, he's not a guy who just gets mauled once he is on the ground. He's a good defensive grappler, but against those upper level jiu-jitsu guys, he does tend to at least not get submitted. Now, the thing about Vince Pichel, and I do feel like he's a little bit different than some of the other grapplers that Hubbard's been in there with, is that he has really good wrestling, but I don't think the jiu-jitsu is really the second kind of part to his game that a lot of those other grapplers are. Like, Davi Hamosh, for instance, well, his whole game is jiu-jitsu. He just so happens to be a really good wrestler. And Marco Madsen is a very good, constant grappler. He doesn't just go for the takedown and stop there. With Pichel, it will be interesting, because if he does just kind of sit in the guard of Austin Hubbard, I do think Hubbard can at least make Pichel work enough in that first round and get back up to his feet to where Hubbard will be able to use his cardio great in that second and third round, and he will start to pull away. So I guess the real question comes down to, how active will Pichel be on top? Because if he is kind of boring, that's when Austin Hubbard is going to be able to move on the bottom and start to get his hips loose and start to create separation. Because Pichel isn't that top tier kind of submission, I guess submission threat. So Hubbard can kind of give his back when he goes up to his feet. He can do a lot of things that you wouldn't normally see in his fights, because I don't think he's going to be worried about the submission threat with Pichel like he has been against some of his other guys. So again, for me, this fight comes down to not only the cardio of Hubbard, but how active will Pichel be in that top position?
Vince Pichel's last wins by submission back on the Ultimate Fighter season 15 against John Coffer and Cody Fister. Matt, in this fight, again, it all comes down to what game plan does Vince Pichel have now out of Factory X? I think it's a great connection and a great way to get ready for a fight like this. All sorts of important training partners. We talked about it with Hernandez, but guys like Yusuf Salal and so on and so forth. A lot of interesting guys there. You know exactly what you're going to get out of Austin Hubbard. 58% takedown defense, too, in the UFC for Hubbard. You don't love it. It's only 20% for Pichel, but again, he can win out in a lot of those scramble situations. You're going to take a negative hit against a guy like Gregor Gillespie, and he's able to get 3.83 per 15 minutes himself. That's absolutely insane. When I look at a fight like this, when I drop my notes, Austin Hubbard open a plus 140. He's a minus 110 right now. Those odds are at par. Pichel open a minus 160. He's now at a minus 112. Matt, odds closing in on par. We'll have a look at Tapology. We haven't seen the votes. There they are, 1,137 total votes, 75% Pichel, 88% by decision. For the 25% that have Hubbard, 76% by decision. Both these guys are decision machines. I know the Rostkov fight, it was a lot of damage, and those leg kicks were great, and Hubbard was able to win. Surprised he would even throw leg kicks based on the compartmentalization syndrome. I like Hubbard in this fight. I know the way that we set it up. I think Pichel can come in with a great game plan. He could surprise me, because I don't agree with the voters, I guess. So I'm kind of in a weird island that I'm on right now. It's Catalina Wine Mixer. Are you there too?
No, I agree 100%. I think 35-year-old Vince Pichel could have at least made this fight a little bit competitive. But at a certain point, we do have to bring into consideration the fact that Austin Hubbard's 9 years younger than Vince Pichel. And Austin Hubbard has great cardio for a guy who is 29. Like, I just think we've kind of seen this fight almost play out before. And I finally feel like this is the wrestler that Austin Hubbard will finally get over. He's starting to do a little bit better against him. We saw glimpses of it in that Madison fight. I do feel like he's finally going to be able to get over that hump of, I just kind of lose to wrestlers every time out there.
Interesting fight. Dakota Bush was able to get one of his total of six takedowns in his last fight. And then for Austin Hubbard, one of one. He had 6 minutes and 42 seconds of control time in that fight. Both of us going with Thud. Austin Hubbard to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. You're not going to want to miss Question Mark Kicks 2 hours live before the prelims, where we offer up our final picks and predictions after the weigh-ins. And keep it locked in, because we got a lot of great stuff coming down the pipe. So as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Today's episode is sponsored by our friends over at Manscaped, the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. And listen, it's back to school time. We're not that far removed from our schooling days. And we want to make sure you pack the essentials to have your best year yet. The Manscaped 4th Generation Performance Package is just that. Listen, things are opening up, and be ready for whatever is in the daily schedule for you. It's a perfect package for your package, and it also includes the brand new 4th Generation Lawnmower 4.0. Just like that, you can hear it. If you're listening in your car or on the plane, you can see it in person. Listen, fellas, go for the, and they wrote this, not me, valedictorian of ball trimming. Join the over 2 million men worldwide who trusted Manscaped by going to manscaped.com with the promo code FNP. Now, Matt, we've all been there before. We've been using that knockoff, big brand box store ball hair trimmer. It's the same trimmer that you use for your head hair, and then you use it on your ball hair. And it just doesn't work out. Now, I've told this story time and again. I'm a shower shaver. So Manscaped, when they rang us up, they said, hey, are you guys interested in partnering with Manscaped? We're going to give it a trial. We're going to give it a go. We're going 9 months strong with Manscaped right now. And I couldn't have been more excited at the time, because obviously I had heard of the product before. You hear a lot of people talking about it. But until you actually get it in your hands, it's really tough to tell. Well, I can tell you that it does work very well. And I've always been a shower shaver of the pubic region, not on my head hair, not on my face hair. I do that in the mirror. But when you're in the shower, the best part of it is you get that 4K light, and you get so many more things with the Performance Package 4.0. The worst part about buying that no-name trimmer is the fact that, A, you have to put AA batteries in a lot of them. Like the one
Who has those?
It's still in the drawer, but it's way at the back. They rust, because normally that's an issue, and they're not waterproof, even if you try to make them. So, hey, kind of heed my warning there. But I haven't had any issues with this one. Like I said, school is back in the Performance Package 4.0 from Manscaped. They're here to teach the boys a lesson on male hygiene. Inside, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0, as I already talked about. They also have the Weed Whacker. Now, you've seen me use this week in, week out. Let's do it, because the nose hair problem is not going away. Wow. I mean, Matt, from that far away, you can really hear it doing work.
You can.
It's going in there. It's going in the corners. It's just like JaVale McGee of the nose and ear hair trimming world. The fourth generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin safe technology. They also have, like I said, that ceramic blade does actually work wonders. The other really nice thing, there's two features I want to show you. I do this week in and week out. I'm traveling back at work now. It has a travel lock. 1, 2, 3. Now the light goes up 3 prongs. It's locked. So you can put it in your luggage. You're not going to have any issues. 1, 2, 3. It's going to go down again. Boom. And now it's going to work. The other thing that you can do that you can't do with some of those cheap trimmers. Now I'm popping that off and you might think, oh, ha ha. But the best part of it is you can clean that out. You get a little bit of brush or a little brush and you can clean the hair out of there. You can oil up the end of the motor. And listen, coming from a background where it's important to put oil in your motors, this is definitely the one that you want. It pops right back on. Just that easy. And I said 4K LED spotlight. It's a 4000K LED spotlight. If you pick up the performance package, you also get the crop preserver. That one is a ball deodorant. It's like a salve. You just slap that stuff on. You also get the crop reviver. And Matt, I'd say guilty as charged. I used this when I was going out on the course the other morning. On Saturday morning, a little bit of a crop reviver. Gave you that nice snug feeling, that nice fresh feeling. You're good to go on one of those sticky days. And if you order the Performance Package 4.0 right now, you're going to get the Manscaped Boxers and the Shed Travel Bag. Everybody could use a nice toiletry bag, especially when you're traveling. One's comfy. They wrote this. One is a comfy front pack for your balls, and the other is your backpack for your goods. That tripped me up for a second. These guys are quirky. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. This year, graduate with a degree in clean balls. From Manscaped, Matt, we've got big time fights coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss any of the videos. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. This is a question that probably gets asked in California all the time, namely in Sacramento. Who can take Darren Elkins the most? That's the question for this fight. Who can take the most damage? We have the Vanilla Gorilla, Chase Sherman, taking on one of John Jones' former opponents, Parker Porter. Matt, this fight at heavyweight, I think it's insane that this is so high up on the card. But for Parker Porter, great opportunity for New Britain, Connecticut's own. Matt, they're the New Britain Yard Goats now. It used to Was it the Rock Cats? What was their AA baseball team in New Britain? Comment down below. But this is a guy that trains out of Underdog Mixed Martial Arts, and perennially an underdog is Parker Porter. A lot of people are surprised when he did end up making it into the UFC because he lost to Keith Bell a little while ago. He beat Kevin Sears. He beat Durley Broenstrup, which was a weird fight because if you look at Broenstrup's overall record, it was a little salty, even though it was a nice winning record. Loses in impressive fashion to Chris Daukaus, and then he ends up beating Josh Parisian. The big comeback story for Chase Sherman, he's out of the UFC, he has great wins with Island Fights, boom, he's back on the marquee, he beats Ike Villanueva, he looks amazing, and then he takes on Andrei Arlovsky, and he just kind of got out-vetted in that fight.
It's a weird fight, because Andrei Arlovsky's had a lot of these fights, I would say kind of like the post-long losing streak of his career.
Like against Tanner Boser.
Exactly. He did have this streak where he has a lot of close fights. And even in the Boser fight, you can make an argument for Tanner Boser. But I don't really think Chase Sherman had much of an argument after that fight. Like, that was a pretty clear-cut win for Andrei Arlovsky. And he won that fight doing those classic Andrei Arlovsky things. Throwing in volume, doing that little shuffle and whatnot. Throwing a lot of jabs. And the weird thing for Chase Sherman was that he just kind of assumed youth would be on his side. And we've seen Andrei Arlovsky lose, 45 fights now? You just thought, okay, Chase Sherman would be able to land that big shot. But he never made any adjustments. And this is the problem with Chase Sherman. You bring up the Island fights. Yeah, they're good. You kind of glossed over the uncomfortable BKFC career where he had some, like, disturbingly close fights with guys who were part-time fighters.
The craziest thing, and you talk about game plans. So Chase Sherman, for his last fight and getting ready, he was training at elevation. Like, he was training at a really, really good gym. And it was just odd to see the way that it played out because I thought, okay, this is the move. And I just wanted to say that because he's training at a Sanford MMA for this one.
Which is normally a great sign. But again, I feel like, do you think Chase Sherman's gotten any better since his UFC 211 win over Rashad Coulter? Be honest.
I think he's incorporated more volume into his game.
Okay, but we can both agree that largely he is still the same fighter from he was back then. Chase Sherman's like a Ben Simmons who never made an all-star game to begin with. Like, Chase Sherman's game has not evolved, although he has gone to different gyms. I don't think Chase Sherman, all of a sudden, now that he's training with Sanford MMA, is going to look like Brennan Allen, to where it's like, oh shit, your striking's gotten very good in such a short amount of time. I don't think Chase Sherman will. I still think he's going to throw, you know, good volume for the heavyweight division, but nothing that's going to, like, blow your hair back or anything. And he's got good but not great leg kicks. And that's the other thing about Chase Sherman. He has good leg kicks, but he doesn't throw them nearly enough. It's one of his better weapons, and when he does use it a lot in his fights, you can tell that they take an immediate effect on his opponent. But it's one of those tools that he just doesn't seem to go to. It's kind of like Jose Aldo at bantamweight. You know he can throw them. He's just more than happy to check them, I guess. The difference is Chase Sherman defensively isn't that good. So for me, I guess it's, will the Park reporter who beat Josh Parisian, can that guy beat Chase Sherman? I think he probably can, but again, with Chase Sherman, I always do go back to that Rashad Coulter win, to where he did look kind of good in that fight. Like, he was light on his feet, he moved around quite a bit, and honestly, he kind of reminded me of, and you're not going to like this, but like, he reminded me a little bit of Ciryl Gane, you know? Like, he moved a lot for a heavyweight. Now, I understand Ciryl Gane is like the Hall of Fame level of it, but Chase Sherman, he was a smaller heavyweight. He threw kicks, he moved. It just wasn't something that you saw a lot in the UFC, even in 2016, and I thought it might separate him from at least the average unranked heavyweight. It never did. And again, that's the problem I keep on going back to with Chase Sherman. Look at the Justin Willis fight. Look at the Walt Harris fight. And I understand Walt Harris is still a decent fighter in the UFC, but like, he's just never been able to make the improvements. And I just look at him as, yes, I will admit he has high volume, but he's just a hittable heavyweight at the end of the day.
Well, the weird thing for Chase Sherman, you bring it up. I mean, you talk about it. There's different players out there on the NBA 2K games that are not meant to have Hall of Fame badges. Like, if you really think about it, I mean, who can we say? Like a Jose Calderon, if he has like, you know, a Hall of Fame ball handling.
He would
badge.
Have Hall of Fame dimer.
That's it. Like, it's really weird. But when you look at it for Chase Sherman, those leg kicks are great. Use them against Villanueva. Villanueva is susceptible, and then he slows right down and they hurt him badly. Can he do it against a guy like Parker Porter? I'm willing to say that he can.
Maybe.
But it's really, really difficult. Matt, when we look at the odds, what do we have for Chase Sherman? What do you think about that? He opened a minus 155. He's a minus 188. Parker Porter opened a plus 135. He's a plus 155 right now. Over on Topology, surprise to me, surprise to you, is there to you. 1,156 total votes. 88% Sherman, 75% nice. By knockout. For the 12% that have Porter, 43% by knockout. Parker Porter has not taken on the same level of guy, except for John Jones, that Chase Sherman has, the level of guy in the UFC, because he's only had two fights, one against Dawkins, who's very good, and one against Josh Parisian, who's Josh Parisian, out of Michigan. So when I look at this one, I like Chase Sherman. I think Henry Hoof's probably going to accentuate the leg kicks.
You're probably
I think
right.
Training with Steve Mowry and training with Linton Vassell, those are good guys up at the weight class to get ready for this fight. Parker Porter's got an overhand chance, but I like Chase Sherman with the volume. Don't necessarily like how his defense is... Just pull my head back.
Yeah.
Just pull my head back. That's how you get cracked by a right hand and knocked out. But for Chase Sherman, I still like him in this fight, but I do worry.
Yeah, I'll pick Chase Sherman. Not a lot of confidence behind the pick, and the fact that he's almost a 2-1 favorite is ridiculous. This fight is as much of a coin flip as any other one on the card, because it is. Parker Porter could land a big shot and put Chase Sherman into next week with it, or Chase Sherman could kind of pitter-patter, and use those leg kicks to full effect. I'll pick Chase Sherman because I guess his cardio is something I can hold on to and say, like, well, this is definitely better than Parker Porter's. But yeah, this is a tough fight to be so far up on the card.
Pitter-patter, let's get at her. Letterkenny, Chase Sherman, Matt, is who we're going with. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Great fights. Up at the top, UFC Hall of Famer Clay Guida. Olympic silver medalist Mark Madsen. Wrestler's Paradise. And in the main event, Jared Cannonier taking on Kelvin Gastelum. I can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Not often we get to see an actual current active UFC Hall of Famer taking on a former medalist at the Olympics, but that's what you have in this weekend's co-main event. It's the Carpenter Clay Guida, a guy who almost reached the pinnacle a lot of different times, taking on the undefeated Mark Madsen representing Denmark, who's 10-0. And so far in the UFC for Mark Madsen, it's been a short little spurt, but he beat the Caterpillar, Danilo Belluardo, almost 2 years ago. He beat Austin Hubbard a year and 5 months ago, and then he's been away. And I've seen him doing a lot of interviews. I've seen him training with a lot of different fighters at Fight Ready in Phoenix. But I haven't seen him fight a lot, and he's almost 37 years old, which is crazy to think of because he's so young in fight years. For Clay Guida, he's almost 40. He's almost a man, but he's fought the highest level competition for years and years and years. Matt, I can remember when you and I get into MMA around 2008, 2009, Clay Guida was in these co-main event type slots, and he's still here now.
So when Anthony Pettis was the WEC lightweight champion, they didn't just give him a lightweight opportunity in the UFC. They weren't like, hey, now you can fight Frankie Edgar. No, his UFC debut was against Clay Guida, and he lost. Clay Guida beat him by split decision. Now, heavily controversial fight, but he kind of set the blueprint for how to beat Anthony Pettis. You put your head in his chest, and you don't let him throw spin and shit. It's pretty easy. Now, much harder than just that, but still.
Clay Collard did it. Clay Collard did it. Alex Manziau did it.
Exactly. Guy's been able to do it as of late. But for Clay Guida, we kind of know what his game is already. Like, he's a good wrestler. He's a good boxer. His jiu-jitsu's okay, but it's never really rounded out like the rest of his game. And he's so far past the hill, he's now in the prairies. And that's the problem with Clay Guida. He's at the stage of his career where Hakeem Olajuwon was wearing a Raptors jersey. It's not the same guy that you once were. And listen, I can admit, I thought he was going to beat Charles Oliveira, and that fight wasn't that long ago, which is very embarrassing for me to say. But again, at the time, I thought that the wrestling of Guida would at least keep that fight on the feet, and I thought Guida would be able to kind of outvolume him on the feet. Now, Clay Guida immediately shoots for a takedown. Charles Oliveira submits him, but we'll leave that in the past. I just don't think Clay Guida is the same fighter that he was back then. And the weird thing about Mark Madsen is that I don't really think the time off is going to bother him at all. And I'd really like to get your opinion on this, because no matter what he does in training, out of training, in fighting, out of fighting, he's still just going to wrestle his opponents. That's never going to change. I don't think Marco Madsen's a guy who needs to go in there and get inactive cage time to really let his skill set unveil itself. We all know what he's going to do. He's going to try to out-wrestle Clay Guida. I don't think the last year and a half of a layoff is going to be the thing that affects him. I just think it's going to come down to Clay Guida's cardio and whether or not Marco Madsen can take him down or not.
Marco Madsen doesn't really have the greatest cardio. That scares me. I mean, against Austin Hubbard a year and 5 months ago, he goes out there, he wins the first two rounds, and then Austin Hubbard comes back at the end. How good's Austin Hubbard? Well, he's on this card, and, you know, if you missed the video, it's or you're halfway through, so you're probably paying attention. Maybe the cats are listening in the background, you're cooking supper. I'm going to say this to you.
I've got Austin Hubbard to beat Vince Pichel. It could be wrong.
So but I've got him to win. But for me, the cardio question from the last fight, it worries me. But the guy's 10-0. Former Olympian, so there's all that. But then the wrestling dynamics come into play. And for Mark Madsen, there's not a ton of huge Greco-Roman wrestlers in MMA. Yes, we can talk about former champions. Yes, we can talk about big names. I mean, what? Who is there?
Daniel Cormier.
There's Mike Grundy. There are Greco-Roman wrestlers in MMA, and there's Greco-Roman wrestlers who've had tons of success. Clay Guida, with freestyle wrestling and active hips, has been able to win a hell of a lot of fights and out-wrestle a lot of really good fighters. And if you look at it for the five on in, he loses to Charles Oliveira 3 years ago. He beats BJ Penn.
The ghost of BJ Penn.
He has a great one round against Jim Miller. He loses to Bobby Green in a very close fight. And then he won his last time out against Michael Johnson, where somebody in the comments section when I put the poll out there yesterday said that in that fight, Michael Johnson beat Clay Guida and it was controversial. No. Wasn't Clay Guida beat Michael Johnson, because we talk about shells. Oh, poor Michael.
That's a rematch we're going to see in the BKFC one day.
I like the menace. But Matt, in this fight, yeah, it really is tricky because Clay Guida does still throw his hair out and about. He does throw a decent amount of volume and his wrestling's still good. And he has a style that still makes him competitive at this point in his career. Can Marco Madsen win the first two rounds and coast through the third? That's my question.
I think he can. I really do. I don't think Clay Guida has the wrestling to defend the level of takedowns that Marco Madsen is going to be bringing into the cage. Because Clay Guida, here's the thing. We never really see him on the defensive with his wrestling because he is always the guy moving forward. Normally what we see is Clay Guida shooting for takedowns, and if the grappling sequence isn't going to work out for him, he just kind of gets tapped in that initial like failed takedown attempt. He does not protect his neck whatsoever, at least in this stage of his career. Charles Oliveira choked him out. And I guess the Brian Ortega one, he did knock him out, but still. Charles Oliveira choked him out. Jim Miller choked him out. Like, there's just, it's been a disturbing path. It's been a disturbing career trajectory for Clay Guida, at least as of late. I understand the Michael Johnson one was a win, but again, beating, and I say this, I mean every word I say, beating the ghost of BJ Penn and Michael Johnson doesn't mean that much to me. I still think Marco Madsen has at least enough of a draw that the UFC believes in Europe to where they're giving him Clay Guida on purpose. And I do think Marco Madsen's going to be able to just out-wrestle him for two rounds. I understand that third round might look fishy, but I don't think Clay Guida has nearly as good cardio as a 29-year-old Austin Hubbard.
You think he's a draw, B?
I don't think he's a draw.
Oh, you don't think he's a draw?
I think he could be. Again, we talk about this sometimes. Like, Chris Moutinho against Sean O'Malley. People were trying to sell Wolf tickets and being like, oh, Chris Moutinho is going to beat him. No, there's a reason the UFC matches some guys up with some opponents sometimes. And I'm not saying Marco Madsen and Clay Guida's this situation, but if Madsen beats Guida, it's a bit of a name that you can kind of use that as an excuse to give him like a Yancy Medeiros next, maybe. Some guy who has a bit bigger of a name, but terrible wrestling defense. And I think there is kind of a path for Mark Madsen to become, and I don't mean a big star, but remember when Emil Mech was like, he was more well-known than the average unranked welterweight?
You beat Paul Harris, you can go anywhere.
Exactly. I could kind of see that being a career trajectory for Mark Madsen. I ever so slightly think he's going to win this
The one. Votes at Fight Night Picks in the YouTube community tab, 76% Madsen to 24% for Clay Guida. The comments. Jonathan Cesari says, Clay looked great in his last fight, even though I think he lost. However, anytime there's a big name on the card, there's a lot of potential to win some money. Hype sways Vegas a lot more than it should. Glenn Power says, I'd love to see Guida win. What a legend. Glenn, I agree with you. He's a legend. Again, when we get into MMA, Clay Guida was at the top. And some big fights at lightweight at that point in time. Rodent Tree Resistance 95, Madsen all day. I'd be surprised if Guida wins this one. And let's say Antsav says Madsen has subpar cardio and he's only better than Guida at Greco-Roman wrestling. My bet is Guida by decision. And let's go with one more. For Devin Stambul... Oh, apologies, Devin. For Devin Stambulziovsky, Guida will outwork him and probably finish him. I'd be surprised if it happened, Devin. Hopefully I get close to your last name's pronunciation. Matt, if we have a look at the odds, Clay Guida open to plus 210 underdog. He's a plus 143 average on best fight odds. For Madsen, open to minus 250. He's a minus 177. The odds have increased for Guida. The fan support in the comments section is there for Guida. I think Madsen's going to be able to bank the first two. But listen, if Guida's able to take over with the pitter-patter, if he's able to even just his way to a couple of invisible strikes that the judges count, maybe he's able to get the win. This fight's really close. I think it's going to go to decision. So the over 2.5 fight to go to decision would be where I'm at. I'm ever so slightly shading Marco Madsen, but again, it's a 50-50 on my card.
I think Marco Madsen should be able to win this one. Again, Clay Guida is not the type of guy who has that kind of power on the outside. Even if Madsen is
tight. Joe Lozon.
Oh, okay. Joe Lozon. Again, you want to talk about old fighters.
4 years ago.
Joe Lozon was good 10 years ago, so that tells you how old he was. But for Marco Madsen, I do think that the wrestling's going to be able to win out. And I don't think Clay Guida, again, even if Madsen's tired in that third round, I don't think Guida has the kind of power or the volume to be able to put him away. So I do feel like this is a case of Madsen is able to bank those first two, kind of go into survival mode in that third round. And hey, he might even be able to still get takedowns in that third round. I'm just going off of what I saw in the Hubbard fight. I still think Madsen should be able to get it done.
Both of us going with Denmark's. Mark Madsen, get the win. Let us know down below if you get the OG legend, the UFC Hall of Famer, the Carpenter, Clay Guida. Absolutely love this fight, and you're not going to want to miss the main event video. Cannoneer taking on Gaslam. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Absolute banger up at the top of UFC Vegas 34. As always, one half your co-hosting team, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. Bobbing and weaving to my left, to your right, Matt Allen FNP on the respective socials. And newsflash, if you haven't checked out our second channel, 15-minute card breaks. We're opening sports cards. We're talking all sports. We're having a good time. It's our second passion. Check it out. Link below down in the description. Matt, let's get into the nuts and bolts and the crux of our entire existence. We got a big time preview of a fight between top 10 ranked middleweights, Jerry Cannonier, Calvin Gastelum, both guys coming off of decision losses to Robert Whittaker. And not every decision loss is created equal, but for Jerry Cannonier, this is a guy that struggled with fights going the distance. He is an excellent finisher and he's fought a very high level of competition. His statement win, well, that was the win before he fought Robert Whittaker. He beat the hometown guy in Jack Hermanson, and he looked amazing in that fight. And for Calvin Gastelum, 1-4 in his last five. Now, in that win against Ian Heinisch, looked amazing. It looked like vintage Calvin Gastelum, the guy you knew and loved from The Ultimate Fighter, who could mix in the wrestling with the striking, who wasn't just a short-range specialist out of that southpaw stance in those phone booth boxing combination type situations. So in this fight, Gastelum has all of those different weapons, and he has youth on his side coming in here at only 29. to Jared Cannonier's 37. Now, I don't know if Jared Cannonier walks into the cage with crystals, so we'll see how that plays out for him. But stylistically, it's a weird fight to try and figure out.
So this is how old Kelvin Gastelum's 29 is, ready? Like, when he sits down, he goes... That's how old Kelvin Gastelum is for a 29-year-old. Because, again, you can't always judge fighters just by how old they are. You have to judge them by how many miles that, I guess, they've taken inside the cage. Craig and I were talking about just like, hey, great chins and great things that we know MMA fighters for. You know why people like Kelvin Gastelum? You know why he's so popular? Because he gets into crazy fights. You know how he gets into crazy fights? Because he eats a lot of head kicks and overhands. I know Kelvin Gastelum has a really good chin because I've seen him be able to eat an insane amount of damage throughout his career. I'm worried that this fight might be that one where he goes a little bit too far. Because the weird thing about Gastelum, and the other thing I have to bring up, and I'm going to sound very Robin Blackie, and I understand I've been all over the place. Robin Black said something after the Robert Whittaker fight that you never want to hear a fighter say. I don't know if you caught this, but he was in the bus, and he was, like, borderline tears with Rafael Cordeiro. He was like, that's the first time I've ever been in there with a guy who, like, I never felt like I could be as good as him. You never want to hear an MMA fighter say that. Like, when Charles Barkley played against Michael Jordan in the finals and had, like, a 35-point triple-double, but Jordan had had 50 points, Charles Barkley was like, that's the first time in my prime I ever felt like someone else was better than me, and Jordan went on to win the next two games in that series. I do think that Kelvin Gastelum has to believe in himself before I believe in Kelvin Gastelum. I understand that sounds kind of out there, but it really is the truth. Like, if Kelvin Gastelum mentally is 100% on, and he does have, he's that tricky southpaw, he's got arguably the best hand speed in the division. I don't think he's got the top tier power that a lot of people say he does, but I do think his hand speed goes a lot, goes a long way when you do talk about Kelvin Gastelum's power. The weird thing about this fight, though, is that Jared Cannonier broke his arm early on against Robert Whittaker, and I don't think we ever were really able to see what 100% Jared Cannonier was able to do against a guy like Robert Whittaker. I saw what Kelvin Gastelum was able to do against Whittaker, and his problem was speed. Well, that was the thing I thought he had the edge over everybody in, and that was the thing about Kelvin Gastelum. I never felt like he was on a massive career decline until his last fight. Even though he lost to Robert Whittaker, and listen, I think Robert Whittaker is 1B probably for best fighter in the middleweight division. Like, him and Izzy are probably head and shoulders above everybody else right now. But in that fight, the speed was an issue for him. So I don't know if coming into this fight, I still think he'll be the faster fighter than Jared Cannonier. But my issue is going to be if he is in the pocket and if he is exchanging punches with Jared Cannonier, four punches from Kelvin Gastelum equal one punch from Jared Cannonier. And I really do think Cannonier has that kind of fight-ending power. I don't think he has the technique that a Robert Whittaker does. He doesn't have the submission game that a Jack Hermanson does. Like, his game might not be as pretty as some of those other guys that Kelvin Gastelum has lost to in the past, but he has that one thing that can erase all those other mistakes and all those other skill sets. He does have that kind of power, and he's got that power on the inside. Jared Cannonier's weird with his power. Like, at range, look at the David Branch fight. He counters him off an inside kick. It was like Poirier against Gaethje. This perfect, fully extended right hand. It's one of those punches you kind of expect to knock out somebody when it lands.
I think there's a lot of parallels between that fight and this fight.
And then you look at the Hermanson fight. He's defending takedowns. He's just being good defensively. But then once he is able to land that uppercut on the inside, it's immediately over. For Hermanson, and the thing that I keep on coming back to in this fight is Kelvin Gastelum could win 4.5 rounds in this fight and still find a way to lose it by eating a big shot from Cannonier. I don't know if Cannonier can go out there and win the rounds consistently like Kelvin Gastelum can, but my issue keeps on coming down to the hitability of Kelvin Gastelum. I think your durability, it's kind of like Dwayne Casey said, you gotta pound the rock. At a certain point, that rock's really durable, but every time you hit it, it's gonna chip away, become more brittle, and I don't think Jared Cannonier is the type of guy you want to be testing your chin against when you're 1-4 in your last 5.
Tell us more, Doris Burke. Matt, when I look at this fight, if you want to play MMA math, Jared Cannonier wins this fight 10 times out of 10. He beat Hermanson, Gastelum lost to Hermanson. Cannonier looked great against Hermanson, Gastelum looked lost. Like, and I think I put...
You're too hard on that performance, I think.
I mean, like, it was so quick, and it was like, you know, it was a weird fight, and I'm going to leave it there. But the things that worry me, Gastelum, if he can be offensive with his takedowns, yes, he hits at a 37% clip so far in the UFC. But if you look at it for Cannonier, 54% takedown defense. So you say, Craig, okay, well, who has taken down Jared Cannonier? I will let you know. Through his entire run in the UFC, Iwan Kutsalaba took him down 6 times, but that was a fight of the night.
He beat him up on the feet, though.
And Cannonier beat him up on the feet. Glover Teixeira took him down 3 times, beat him by decision. Glover's Glover, up a weight class. Jan Blachowicz took him down 4 times. Okay, but what did he do to Israel Adesanya up there? And then you kind of get into the weeds. It's a little weird. Like, David Branch took him down 3 times, but he knocked him out.
But this is the difference between him at light heavyweight, heavyweight, and him at middleweight. Well, I remember...
You remember making my own point for me?
No. Kama Worthy was a fighter that we used to bring up a lot. Because, and again, now he started getting stopped at 155, so the point isn't still as good as it once was. But he was a fighter that you really had to separate into two guys by weight classes. And I just feel like Cannonier is one of those guys.
Which is where I was going with everything I was saying. But yeah, with Cannonier, once you start moving down, you talk about point of diminishing returns. Well, it's kind of the opposite. And again, the guys that are taking him down, I know David Branch, his second UFC run was bad. Even his first UFC run wasn't that good. Gerald Harris was able to negate two of the fence grabs and throw him down and knock him out. But part and parcel of what's good about David Branch's game, long-range striker, wizard on the ground, double weight champ over with World Series of Fighting for what it was worth. Now, he got a main event against Luke Rockhold. That was weird. But everything that he's good at, Jared Cannonier was able to somewhat negate and finish him in that one. Same thing with Jack Hermanson. For Kelvin Gastelum, can he wrestle in this one? Can he utilize his short-range weapons against a guy like Jared Cannonier? We're going to find that one out. If you do have a look at the odds for this fight, Cannonier is the favorite. He opened at a minus 240s and minus 158. Those odds took a big jump last week in the middle of the week or so. They've kind of moved a little bit today too. Gastelum opened a plus 195. He's a plus 131 right now. And Matt, we like to have fun with it. Check it out over in the YouTube community tab. We threw it out there. Out of 621 total votes, 57% Cannonier, 43% for Gastelum. Some of the top comments out there, the Blue Dash says this is a really weird fight to call. I can see Gastelum just outpointing him through all rounds, or Cannonier being the first man to knock out Gastelum.
I can see it.
The next one, you've got myself saying, going to be tough for Kelvin to fight from the outside when Jared has a 6-inch reach advantage. Kelvin gets caught coming in and Jared finishes this by knockout. Artem MMA analysis says, close fight, can't wait to see your boys, or you boys, picks. And
you're part of the video now.
We've got Viljami Naiminen. Don't know what everybody's seeing on Gastelum, so there's that too. When I look at this fight, I do have a hard time because, again, Gastelum was able to out wrestle Ian Heinisch, who's a good wrestler, which screws around with me because statistically Jared Cannonier is not a good wrestler, but I know he's been better at middleweight. Can Cannonier last? That's all the question that I really have. The broken arm in Whitaker kind of freaks me out a little bit again. Because you talk about it, how long ago was that fight? 9 months ago? Victoria Leonardo broke her arm at the start of the year and then re-broke it against Melissa Gatto of all people. And that was the end of the fight. The doctor came in between the second and third. Nope, can't do it anymore. I have a lot of question marks about Cannonier that I can't be confident enough to go, okay, I'm laying the hammer down on Cannonier. I like Cannonier in this fight, but those are the things that scare me here.
So the issue is that Kelvin Gastelum's position where he's going to be able to get the most done is going to be the most dangerous position for him to be in. Because again, Jared Cannonier not only has the reach advantage, so in those longer ranges, and the other thing is, another guy's going to throw a lot of kicks. This is going to be one of the more boxing-heavy main events that you'll see probably since Max Holloway fought Calvin Kattar.
When Rob Font fought Cody Garbrandt.
There you go. Another good example. I do think Jared Cannonier, though, with those leg kicks that we saw in the Anderson Silva fight, he will be able to chip away a little bit at Kelvin Gastelum at the long range. And that's going to make Gastelum start to at least be a little bit more tentative when he rushes in. Or, sorry, the complete opposite way. He's going to start rushing into the gap a lot more because he's not going to want to get eaten up on the outside. And I do think that's where it's the most dangerous when you're fighting a guy like Cannonier. And for Cannonier, like, this is the best time to fight Kelvin Gastelum for 25 minutes. You're never going to catch him a better part in his career. He doesn't really believe in himself right now, and he's 1-4 in his last five. And if
he
you
didn't believe in himself after a career-altering loss.
Is it career-altering when you lose 3 in a row, and then the guy he lose to is the former champ and was better than the 3 guys? Like, not really. My issue is, Kelvin Gastelum's never been at the lowest point in his career, though. And if he is able to beat Jared Cannonier, they could swing this all around, and we start forgetting about a lot of those losses on his record. The issue is that he is 1-4 in his last 5, and even I like to look at some of the things Kelvin Gastelum has done in the past and try to project that onto the future, but just look, like, what have you done for me lately? It hasn't been that good. Ian Heinisch isn't really a top tier fighter, I don't believe, anymore. Look what Nassourdine Imavov was able to do to him. So although it was a good win for Gastelum, I don't look at that as like, wow, that really breaks your losing streak as a top tier fighter. So for me, I'll picture it Cannonier, but this should be a fun fight for as long as it lasts.
Both of us going with the Killer Gorilla representing... Really, it's Arizona now, but by way of Alaska, I mean, listen, not a lot of pro athletes representing a lot, like the Scott Gomez's of the world.
Did Kurt Schilling?
Kurt Schilling. There's a lot of there's names up there, but really love to see it and a great fight. Make sure you check out Question Mark Kicks. It's 2 hours before the prelims. On Saturday, we offer up our final picks and predictions for this entire card. Any fights that are added, we'll be adding them throughout the week. I know this is a little bit later of a drop, but hey, if you missed last week, it was a great one. 7-2, 6-3 with PFL and Bellator main card picks. And if you are so inclined, give us a follow. We'd really appreciate it, not just here, because listen, there's over 50% of you that aren't subscribed. You check in every week, you hang out with the boys, tossing a like. Hit the button, hit the bell. Then at least you know when we go live. And if you really like us talking and you want to hear us talk about some other sports, we do have 15-minute card breaks. We say let's tear the cover off. We're opening cards, we're talking about sports, and we have a lot of fun with it. And it's a lot of fun with everybody in the comments section. So we really do appreciate the support. Hopefully you enjoyed the videos. Comment below with your picks, your predictions, and what you like on this card. We'll catch you on Saturday. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it.